You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Yasha Levine. He is a Russian-born American investigative journalist and a founding editor of The Exiled. His work has been published in The Baffler, Pando Daily, Wired, Nation, Penthouse, and many others. He and his wife, Evgenia, split their time between New York and St. Petersburg, Russia. His book, which I highly recommend, is called Surveillance Valley. He is also the author of a recent article called Know Your History. Google has been a military intel contractor from the very beginning. Yasha Levine, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. I know this was prompted by some Google employees speaking out against a Google military contract. What is the status of Google as a military contractor?
I think it's still pretty healthy. It's still going on, as far as I know. I mean, they canceled. They said that they weren't going to renew this one contract that they had with the Pentagon to do drone AI visual recognition technology, which is called Project Maven. So they weren't going to renew that because of the outcry from their employees, but also from the public. But all the other contracts that they have, and a lot, some of which we don't even really are classified, so we don't even know that they exist. But we can speculate on them. Those things are keep going. I mean, you can search the federal contract database, and their contracts with pretty much every federal agency. Including the Pentagon, and Border Control, and the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, Highway Patrol. So it's very much a police it's very much a law enforcement and military contractor, just like most other tech companies.
I mean, your book makes them sound even more than most other major tech companies as a major player, as a partner with the military and the CIA and part of the PRISM NSA program that Edward Snowden leaked information about, and really a partner with the government on military and surveillance projects. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, that's accurate. But I think that Google isn't really – it's, of course, look, every company should be looked at separately, because every company, every big tech company has its own unique sort of history products that it offers things that intelligence agencies and the Pentagon want from these or can get from these companies. But I would think that we should look at Google not as an isolation, but as part of the larger Silicon Valley complex, which is very much, we like to think of it, and definitely Silicon Valley wants us to think of, these companies as completely separate from the government, as completely separate from the military-industrial complex, and that, in fact, they are our defenders. Right, and they are the only thing that's standing in between us and this sort of surveillance state that wants to spy on us, that wants to exploit us, that wants to kill us, that wants to do all these things. And they've been very effective at projecting that image. But of course, they're very much a continuum. In many cases, they're privatized versions, privatized aspects of the surveillance state and of the military-industrial complex. And you have to remember that the NSA doesn't run its own mobile phones. It doesn't have its own operating system, right? It doesn't have iPhones, right? We don't use the NSA's iPhones,
right?
We use Apple's iPhones, and we use Google, right? And we use Android. So the NSA could not spy on us as effectively as it does if we didn't have these private systems, telecommunication systems that we use. And so the surveillance apparatus is actually very privatized. Right, because all that the NSA does is actually just connect to it,
right,
and siphon data out of it, and as Edward Snowden showed, every major tech company, from Yahoo to Microsoft to Apple to Google to Facebook, is part of the PRISM program, which allowed the NSA along with the CIA to install these custom data taps in the data warehouses of these companies and allow them to essentially request any kind of information that they wanted on the user. And it, you know, and it came complete with text alerts and things like that that would send a notification to an NSA analyst saying, "Hey, the target that you're watching is online and isn't, you know, emailing right now."
Yeah.
So you can like log in and look at this stuff. So, you know, these are partnerships that exist no one knew about them until Edward Snowden blew the whistle on this. And of course, there are business relationships as well.
Yeah.
And Google is not just a partner in the surveillance partner with intelligence agencies, American intelligence agencies, but is also a business partner, and it sells customized solutions, data solutions to the NSA, to the CIA, to pretty much every federal law enforcement and intelligence agency there is.
Right.
And these are versions of kind of the consumer stuff that we use, but souped up versions of those things.
Right. Yasha Levine, I should make clear that your book, which is tremendous, Surveillance Valley, does not focus exclusively on Google. And I'm not intending to pick on Google as the exclusive corporation at fault here. I'm just trying to make sense of the protest by Google employees, because frankly, I'm thrilled that anything like it, no matter what its flaws or errors, could happen at all. And so I'm wondering, when you document that, you know, Google's partnered with Lockheed Martin on projects around the occupation of Iraq and so forth, are Google employees ignorant of what Google has been doing all these years, or are they objecting to a particular type of weaponry, as some people oppose automated drones, but they don't oppose drones where a human being pushes the kill button? What is going on here?
That's a really good question, and I was struggling to understand that myself. I think there's a combination of things that are happening. I think Donald Trump plays a big role in this, and the fear surrounding automated weapon systems and automated AI weapon systems also plays a role in this. I'll say that Donald Trump has been a total disaster for Silicon Valley, a total public relations disaster, because what was seen by many as sort of okay under the Obama administration as the close collaboration between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon was looked at, people were willing to ignore it, I think, much more readily, because Obama represented something that he represented a positive force, I think, to a lot of people in Silicon Valley, to people who worked in Silicon Valley. It was somehow easier to work with the Pentagon and
right.
to think that, well, yeah, we're helping the Pentagon, but, you know, it's like, we're just, you know, it's all right. Like, it's not a big deal. But with Donald Trump, those relationships have become much harder to ignore in Silicon Valley to workers. That is my sense of it. And so they're thinking like, okay, we're now directly aiding this administration, this horrible administration that's doing all these horrible things. So sort of the ugly, it became much harder to hide the ugly face of American imperialism with Donald Trump at the helm.
Wow.
And I think a lot of people began to see their companies as part of the problem, you know, because they're colluding and helping the Trump administration do these things. And they don't trust Obama. I mean, they don't trust Trump to make the right decisions with, you know, a killer AI drone fleet. Whereas maybe under Obama, they would have maybe given him the benefit of the doubt, or given the Pentagon the benefit of the doubt. And so there is a perception shift that has happened with the election of Donald Trump, and I mean, I'm very. It's one of the, to me, it's one of the, you know, small but positive things that has happened because of Donald Trump is because of the collusion between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon has been harder to ignore for a lot of people in the industry.
It's a very interesting answer. I was predicting falsely, erroneously, and hoping that we would see that sort of shift in a major way in terms of peace demonstrations in the streets by ordinary people. Mm-hmm. Yet when I saw that Google protest, I didn't understand it in those terms. But you may be absolutely right that Google employees are objecting because the president is Trump.
It's the first time. Look, I've been covering this the collusion between the military or the relationship between Silicon Valley and the military-industrial complex now since, I'd say, for about 6 years, specifically, just this topic. I've been covering it and writing articles about it and exploring that relationship. And I have not seen critical coverage of this relationship until Donald Trump was elected. I mean, there was coverage of it, and you can read it, you know, in the New York Times, you can read it in Wired magazine, stories that look into various projects that are being pursued collaboratively between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon, but they're always objective and very neutral. They weren't critical. They were just sort of reporting the facts, you know, and maybe even positively. As a new kind of better way of managing empire or whatever. Yeah. But after Donald Trump, the coverage, even from publications that would normally be very sort of enthusiastic about anything that Silicon Valley does, has become much more critical and are willing to go there much more readily, and it's much more acceptable. So yeah, I think Donald Trump is a big headache for Silicon Valley because that sort of progressive image that they've been able to craft all through the Obama administration, because a lot of these companies, if you remember, I mean, they don't really even go back to the Bush era, really, in the public imagination. I mean, they may have existed, right, but they weren't really as popular back then.
Right.
And so these companies have become as powerful as they are today just in the last decade. And so their whole messaging and their public relations strategy has been crafted around that perception of America, which people had under Obama, and so it's they haven't been able to transition very well. They've been floundering and struggling with it, and they've been getting hit hard. And so I'm glad for that.
Right.
I just hope that it doesn't happen if like another president comes in who is, you know, maybe a little bit more progressive or is a Democrat, and suddenly everything's okay again. Right.
Well, I hope more can be done about it than just the protest we've seen thus far from a minority of employees at Google. Yasha Levine, in the book Surveillance Valley, I wish we had an hour for each chapter. I mean, this goes through history back to the development of computers and the Internet. But I in the limited time we have, I want to jump first to the final chapters because they relate to the topic of Google and to the well-known figure of Edward Snowden. I mean, Google's search interests, advertising interests mesh perfectly, as you describe them, with the interests of the surveillance state. And Google tried for years to keep this secret from its customers/users/victims. Mm-hmm. And you describe Edward Snowden as having, you know, the key threat in his hands, the ability to expose and ruin the nefarious practices of these private corporations. And you fault Edward Snowden for choosing not to do so for ideological reasons. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, no, Edward Snowden was kind of a big letdown because here he was, you know, the most famous whistleblower and leaker of our time. The global spotlight was on him, and the first reporting that came out around when he first leaked his documents was about the collusion of the biggest Silicon Valley companies and the NSA and how they were working together to create this global surveillance system and the program that we talked about, PRISM. And so there was this huge upswell of concern about this, and people were really outraged. People were protesting. People wanted to do something. Suddenly, privacy was at the forefront. Internet privacy was at the forefront of the national and global debate. But what Edward Snowden chose to do there was to not direct people or to call people to, you know, go and become politically active and go and do something to start some kind of movement to change politics, to change the laws, to change the political culture of our society so that this kind of behavior would not be tolerated. To basically regulate surveillance, both private and government. He didn't do that. He didn't want to regulate or didn't want to ban surveillance through political and legal means. He channeled people's energy into technological solutions to our privacy. So he was very skeptical of politics. because he is a libertarian and he doesn't really believe in organized politics. He believes that it's corrupt and that it will always be corrupted. And so the only true way to protect our privacy and to guarantee our privacy on the internet was to use technology and to use cryptographic tools. And so he channeled everybody's energy, you know, this energy, this upswell of energy, to do something about our privacy, to solve the problem that had been ignored for so long and allowed to sort of develop behind the scenes. He channeled it into tools like the Tor Project and to these apps called Signal and some other ones. But these very, very narrow tools that protect your privacy on the internet, but in these very, very narrow circumstances, you know, so, okay, one tool will protect your browsing history from your ISP. Another tool will make it harder for, you know, law enforcement to read your text messages. But that is something, you know, that is a tiny little problem that solves a tiny little problem, but it doesn't address the root, the problem at its root, which is that you have this industry, Silicon Valley, that's based on surveillance as a business model, and that this business connects very closely and tightly to the national security state, and to somehow regulate that relationship and to make sure that giant corporations can't spy on us, to make that illegal in some way, and to try to rein in the power of government surveillance as well.
Yeah.
He just went purely techno.
But why? He's a smart guy, obviously. Why would he? I mean, hasn't every previous arms race involved each side upping the other? I mean, why would there be a secrecy tool that ordinary people would develop? And we'll get to the fact that they didn't. That the government would be permanently incapable of ever surmounting. Has any other arms race ever involved that unlikely scenario?
Of course not. No, I mean, look, Edward Snowden is unfortunately a victim of his own ideology, right? And his libertarian ideology led him to this narrow vision of how to tackle political problems. And so, and it's you know, the way that I think about it is it's a very NRA kind of way of looking at the world, National Rifle Association viewpoint, which is that, you know, that you need that, you know, the only way to protect yourself from government surveillance or from exploitation of some kind is to arm everybody so that everybody has to have their own gun. And that is the only way that you can protect yourself from government power. And what Edward Snowden was suggesting was that everybody arm themselves with their own crypto gun, with their own encryption weapon, so that they can protect individually. They can take an individual action to protect their own you know, data sovereignty or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then we would have this sort of, you know, this sort of standoff always with the government. And that if enough citizens and people joined in this revolt, you know, we would be able to neutralize government power. But the problem with Edward Snowden is that he very quickly stopped talking about corporate surveillance and private surveillance. And he was actually saw companies like Google and companies like Apple as part of the resistance. To, you know, part of the privacy resistance, because it was these companies that could, that were the internet, right? That these are the companies that we used to access the internet, to do anything on the internet. And so he called on them and engineers that worked at these companies to be part of the resistance, to build these weapons and to protect regular users from the government. And so very quickly for him, he went away from looking at corporate surveillance and how that tied into with government surveillance and just looking very narrowly at government surveillance and what people can do to protect themselves from government surveillance. And so that was the big letdown of the Edward Snowden saga, I think, and a very big missed opportunity for him and for the world.
Yeah. But beyond that, and beyond the question of whether secrecy is somehow good for nonviolent organizing now, when it never was before the latest technologies that also facilitate all kinds of immoral crimes and so forth, there's the question. I mean, and this seems like a big claim that comes late in your book that you base on Freedom of Information Act request produced documents that Tor and Signal and some of these technologies that are going to save us from the government were actually military projects to begin with.
Yeah, look, exactly. And they're military projects, and they're projects that are funded by this wing of the U.S. government that is involved in projection of soft power. And so Tor and Signal are right now funded by the U.S. government as tools that to arm dissidents in foreign countries and to make it harder for countries like China and for countries like Russia and countries like Iran to control their own sovereign internet space, right? So because those tools, first of all, hide, you know, allow activists to organize away from the prying eyes of their government, right? And to do things, you know, in a way that the government can't see, but also allows you to sort of punch through national firewalls that are erected by these governments to protect themselves from, you know, what these governments see as American propaganda and American efforts to destabilize their countries using, you know, propaganda and various other means, psychological means that is broadcast through the internet. And so these tools come out of specifically the Broadcasting Board of Governors. And the Broadcasting Board of Governors comes out of a CIA-funded psychological warfare program that started in the Cold War. Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty came out of that. And so it was taken out of the CIA in the 1970s and became funded in the open by Congress. But these are the structures where these privacy tools come out of. They come out of government structures. They come out of intelligence-linked structures. And they are funded by the government because they're seen as tools of empire that can project power, American power, in the age of the internet.
And they don't work, mm-hmm. right?
Well, I mean, they work on some level, you know. So, I mean, if you're like a coke dealer, maybe, you know, and you're trying to hide your communication with your clients from the local police department, right? Yeah, they'll probably work because the local police department is not going to, you know, expend the energy to decrypt that and to get the FBI involved, right, in this kind of investigation. But if you're taking on government power, if you're taking on the NSA, right?
Yeah.
These tools, while they might offer some protection, in the end, will only give you a false sense of privacy. Well, first of all, because you can be arrested, your phone can be seized, and your phone can be hacked physically, and all the messages that you have can be retrieved. That's what happened with a lot of the people who were protesting Donald Trump's inauguration, J20 protesters.
Right.
They were organizing through Signal, and they were all arrested, and then their phones obviously ended up with the police, and they were cracked, and all of their messages got used against them in the court as evidence. And so people thought that they were organizing and they were planning these actions totally, and nothing that they said would ever be available to the U.S. government. They were wrong. WikiLeaks published this trove of CIA hacking tools that showed that the agency has the ability to hack phones on a operating system level, so that it doesn't even matter if the app is encrypting anything. The CIA can get at the information before the app even encrypts the information. So, there are all these things there are limitations to these tools. But I think their biggest limitation is not even that they can't hide you from the U.S. government, but that they take away people's attention away from which I think is a more important issue, which is corporate surveillance and private surveillance, because that is the main issue of our day. The tools that we use every day online, Google, Facebook, their business models are built on surveillance. They're built on psychological profiling, and they're built on targeted advertising, which means targeting people for influence based on their psychological profile, right? And selling that influence to the highest bidder.
Yeah.
When Snowden says use Tor and use Signal, those two tools do not protect you at all from Facebook. They don't protect you at all from Google. At all. Zero protection. And
yeah.
So what it does is it makes people think that they're protecting their privacy. And in some cases, in some narrow cases, they are protecting their privacy. But they are completely leaving themselves open to corporate surveillance by companies like Google and Facebook. And Even worse, they think that they're doing something positive. They think that they're protecting themselves, and they might even feel good and then move on to other things in their life, right? So it sucks out the air from what should be a larger privacy movement and concern and just redirected to this very, very narrow kind of protection, and makes people think that they did it. You know, oh yeah, I'm doing what I can. I downloaded this app. I'm using it. I fixed my privacy. Meanwhile, you have Google just siphoning your entire life and using it for their own profitability and leasing it out to political campaigns, making it available to the NSA, to the FBI, to the CIA, all these things, right? Yeah. And so I think that's the bigger problem with focusing on these apps and these technological solutions is that they are very, very narrow, and they don't address the bigger problem, which is, of course, corporate spying.
Indeed. We've got just a couple of minutes left. What does this mean for ordinary people, for activists, for whistleblowers? What bad advice are people being given?
Well, look, I think that we need to look at the internet as not something that's separate from our world and from our politics, but as something very deeply rooted in it. The internet is dominated by spies and by giant corporations because our society is dominated by those things. In order to return, the internet and make it somehow more democratic and make it useful to regular people, and we have to actually make society more democratic and somehow useful and beneficial to regular people, right? So those things are not disconnected. And so we have to, I think, move away from technological solutions to privacy, and think of internet privacy as part of a larger anti-corporate movement of some kind. It has to be firmly planted in a larger politics, in a larger political movement.
Is Europe doing that at all with its new laws? They make any difference?
I think it's a good idea what they're doing, and it is making things more transparent, but I don't think it's very democratic. I think it's still very much, top-down driven, and Europe might be better at regulating these companies because, America doesn't regulate its own internet companies at all. Europe is a bit better, but I don't think it's still part of a larger political movement, right? If it's not like – it's not part of a political movement.
Yeah.
So I think that, we're having a kind of resurgence of left-wing politics now. People are pushing for public health care and Medicare for all and a kind of an attempt to reorient some of these really exploitative structures in America that actually make them actually work for people, right, rather than against them. And so I think the internet needs to be a part of that, needs to be a plank in that, right? That you need to reorient the internet from just being the surveillance tool that enriches these giant corporations and enriches the intelligence databases of our military-industrial complex.
We will have to end it there. It's a good note to end it on. I highly recommend the book, which we've barely touched the surface of, Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. Yasha, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Have a good day.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, like all discrimination, Islamophobia is political and personal, individual and institutional, subtle and not at all subtle. A recent incident led Maha Hilal to connect those dots in an essay. Maha Hilal is co-director of the Justice for Muslims Collective and an organizer with Witness Against Torture. We'll talk with her about her piece, White Supremacy in the Courtroom, and the story behind it. Also on the show, if you search endangered species online, you will find many beautiful photographs of foxes and leopards and bears. If the Trump White House has its way, pictures may be all that you can see. We spoke with Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, about the current assaults on the Endangered Species Act. That's all coming up, but first, a quick look back at recent press. As of July 2nd, it has been a calendar year since nominal liberal network MSNBC has aired a segment mentioning U.S. participation in the war on Yemen, which has killed more than 15,000 people and resulted in over a million cases of cholera. The U.S. is backing a Saudi-led bombing campaign with intelligence, refueling, political cover, military hardware, and as of March, ground troops. But as Adam Johnson notes for Fair.org, none of that seems to rate with what Adweek calls the network of the resistance, which has, since its last mention of the U.S.'s role in the destruction of Yemen, run over a dozen segments highlighting war crimes committed by the Syrian and Russian governments in Syria and more than 400 segments on Stormy Daniels. Can it be done? Well, yes. The PBS NewsHour just ran a three-part series on the war. The second part was headlined, "American-Made Bombs in Yemen Are Killing Civilians, Destroying Infrastructure, and Fueling Anger at the U.S." So it's hard to imagine MSNBC editors thinking deeply and concluding that Trump's war in Yemen isn't newsworthy. It's much easier to picture them deciding that Russia and scandal are easy sells. And anyway, Yemenis aren't going to pull ads, turn down appearances, or phone Comcast higher-ups with complaints. And in the Everything Old is New Again department, Dean Baker calls our attention to Roger Lowenstein in the Washington Post, offering readers of his business section perspective the following pearl. Quote, "But what if inequality is the wrong metric? Here with a modest proposition. Economic inequality is not the best yardstick. What we should be paying attention to is social mobility." Close quote. Baker fails to find the novelty, given that right-wingers have been pushing that line since the dawn of time. Don't worry that your standard of living is awful. The important thing is that your kids will be able to get rich. Well, the point of this particular iteration comes when you read, quote, "It's also far from proved, to me it's not even intuitive, that high incomes on Wall Street and elsewhere are the reason for, say, flatter wages in manufacturing. The fact that Mark Zuckerberg is so rich is annoying, and his separateness from Main Street may not be a great thing socially, but in an economic sense, his fortune did not come from the paychecks of ordinary workers." Close quote. Well, Dean Baker explains that, actually, people who get incredibly wealthy from exploiting monopolies and avoiding taxes do attain that wealth at the expense of others. And with productivity growing at an incredibly slow rate for the last dozen years or so, it seems like in aggregate, these incredibly rich folks are much better at generating wealth for themselves than for the economy as a whole. So what about structuring our economy so that it makes less difference whether someone ends up at the top, like Jeff Bezos, or at the bottom, earning minimum wage? That idea is apparently too simple for the great ponderers to ponder. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. anti-Muslim hatred, assaults, intimidation, vandalism have increased in this country since September 11, 2001, with investigation dishearteningly suggesting the sharpest spikes have been since 2015. Media play a role. New research illustrates what we already knew, that attacks labeled terrorist get volumes more coverage. One new study says 357% more coverage when the assailant can be connected with Islam. It's hard now to even measure what has been lost and willfully surrendered in the so-called war on terror. One way is to look at Guantanamo Bay, where hundreds of Muslim men and boys were held and dozens remain, subject to torture, most never even charged with a crime. Just as Guantanamo is not just a prison, but a representation of state violence and lawlessness, sometimes an incident, as one reported recently by our next guest, can represent the intersecting layers of injustice that make up Islamophobia. Maha Hilal is co-director of Justice for Muslims Collective and an organizer with Witness Against Torture. She joins us now by phone from Arlington. Welcome back to Counterspin, Maha Hilal.
Thank you so much, Janine.
Well, I would just ask you, if you would, to tell the story of July 11th when you went to the U.S. District Court in D.C. Why were you there, first of all, and what happened?
Yeah, so I, you know, went to the court on the morning of July 11th, intending to hear the oral arguments in Elbihani versus Trump, a case that's based on the indefinite detention of 11 prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. And as you know, and probably many of your viewers know, there has been very little justice for prisoners at Guantanamo, particularly those who've remained in detention for over a decade now. So I was pretty excited about this, the oral arguments, and to really think about what justice could look like and perhaps if justice would come to the prisoners. And as a, you know, visible Muslim woman, I recognized that in many of these settings, you know, when I go into a space that's national security, that I inevitably invite scrutiny and oftentimes surveillance as well. So I went into the courtroom and I sat in the first row. And after doing so, the officer, his name was Officer Collins, came and told me that I needed to sit in the second row because the first row was reserved for attorneys. So I sat in the second row, and I had my phone out on my notebook, but I wasn't actively using the phone. And he then approached me and told me I needed to put it away, which I did. But I think I looked visibly annoyed when he made that request of me, but more so because of the context that I was in and, you know, being really anxious about the oral arguments that were about to happen. He then told me that I needed to follow him outside of the courtroom, so I did. And he told me that when he gives me an order, I need to listen to him and not give him attitude, and then said I was done for the day. And at that point, I was sort of in shock because I really didn't understand what behavior I had exhibited that would warrant this kind of treatment. It's not like I got up in the middle of the hearing and disrupted. I didn't make any noise. The only thing that I had done was to have an annoyed facial expression. And for me, standing there outside the courtroom thinking about, I was literally kicked out because I had a facial expression that this officer didn't like. And what does that mean for the amount of discretion these individuals have to pursue these rules that are really, when there is that much discretion, it means that you can use your discretion on people you don't like, right? And it means that those who you deem as not following the rules typically tend to be people of color. So for me, that was a shock, and also the fact that the officer was a person of color as well, and sort of not recognizing the many layers of irony in this situation.
Well, it pulls on so many different threads, which I'm guessing is why you wrote this essay for Truth Out, White Supremacy in the Courtroom. So many things are happening. There is the disjunct that's just, you know, hard to bear between your being, you know, charged and thrown out for the offense of giving attitude in this space where such immense inhumanity is present.
Right.
You know, this is a case about Guantanamo Bay. I mean, that disjunct is painful.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was very painful.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, again, the irony and knowing what was being heard in the courtroom that day. And, you know, it had been suggested to me that perhaps he wasn't aware of what the hearing was. And I find that hard to believe simply because of the fact that many of these issues that are heard in the courts often invite scrutiny in terms of protesting. So I would assume that officers who are placed in courtrooms where there might be some sort of protest will be informed of the content of the hearing.
Absolutely. And then there is the feeling that is so common for some of us of selective enforcement, of being singled out. And people always want to say, but you can't prove that they picked you because you're Black, for example. You can't, you know, even though everyone was talking and you were the one they said was loud, you know, you can't prove it. And it's just such a common, you know, daily feeling for some of us as we move through the world of being looked at a certain way, of being singled out, and particularly in situations where it's up against officialdom, you know, official power, which always has a latent violence behind it. You know, there always is when an officer yanks you out somewhere, it's hard not to feel the power disjunct between the two of you.
Yeah, and if they take a broader approach, I mean, the point of a lot of the ways that Muslims have been targeted is not just to target those in specific individuals. It's to send a message to the entire community that you too could be targeted, that you too will be surveilled, that you too will be profiled. So it's very frustrating when they then turn around and do that and act as if you're the one that doesn't know what's happening. And we know exactly what's happening, right? Those who are being targeted repeatedly and constantly know exactly what the state's agenda has been and is. And that's because that's what they have done time and time and time again.
Well, when we last spoke with you back in March, we were talking about Gina Haspel possibly being made head of the CIA. And then a few months later, in her confirmation hearing, we see a big New York Times headline, Gina Haspel, nominee for CIA, says era of torture is over. She talked about the interrogation program casting a shadow over what has been a major contribution to protecting this country. And it reminded me of something you said back in March, which was that there's not much point in having a debate about Gina Haspel, about her personal relationship to torture or her moral compass, that we have to be having the bigger conversation about the CIA itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the points that I kept reiterating in that discussion is, you know, there was this argument that was actually used on sort of the left / progressive side that she's not qualified to lead the CIA. But that ignores the whole entire history of the CIA. The CIA is a brutal institution of state violence. So in that way, she's very qualified to lead this organization. And, you know, it's very frustrating to be at this juncture in time when there is a lot of information, a lot of historical information, where we know what these institutions have been responsible for, right? You know, the thing I like to link it to now that this has come about, is the movement to abolish ICE. And I think that that's a very powerful statement, because we're acknowledging the reality that some institutions were designed to inflict massive state violence onto communities. So if we want to think about what it's going to take to stop that violence, it's not going to be about reforming these organizations. It's going to be about dismantling these organizations. And so I think that we have to be really critical about, especially from people of color, what are we asking for and what are the ways that we're actually going to get justice? And if similar institutions continue to exist, that's not going to happen.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, I'm very sorry that you didn't get to be in the courtroom for those oral arguments. What should we know about Al-Bihani versus Trump going forward? Because for reasons that we've only touched on, you know, there isn't going to be maybe the scrutiny on it that there should be. But what's going on there with that case?
Well, you know, it's interesting because on the side of the lawyers who are defending the prisoners, I mean, the argument is that you can't indefinitely detain people, right? There has to be an end to this nebulous war. On the government side, their argument was that you can continually detain people for as long as this war lasts, even if it's 100 years, and there is no set sort of deadline for when this might happen. And, you know, I think one of the problems here, when you're talking about the legal system post-9/11, which is, you know, the context that I examine my research and writing, is that a lot of times you're not actually, at the end of the day, talking about legality and illegality. You're talking about who has the power to enforce a set of rules and laws, right? So what you have is people making very legitimate, sound arguments, but because the legal system is steeped in white supremacy, racism, anti-Blackness, Islamophobia, xenophobia, it becomes less about what the law actually is. Right. And especially when you can just rewrite the law, as we saw with the torture memo, for example. So it becomes less about what the law actually is and who has the power to enforce these very brutal, oppressive systems.
We've been speaking with Maha Lal, co-director of Justice for Muslims Collective and an organizer with Witness Against Torture. Her essay, White Supremacy in the Courtroom, Why I Was Booted from a Hearing on Guantanamo, can be found on truthout.org. Maha Lal, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much, Janine.
Like Social Security, the Endangered Species Act is, historically and presently, very popular. People in the main get the idea that trying not to wipe species off the face of the earth is a meaningful way to reflect the recognition that human life is sustained and enriched by a healthy and diverse environment. And, as with Social Security, there are some who see the Endangered Species Act as primarily an obstacle keeping them and their friends from making the maximum amount of money possible. The trouble is, too often, media seem to balance those perspectives in reporting on the act. Now the Trump administration is going all out to push back on central parts of the Endangered Species Act. What sort of reporting would make clear what's at stake and why we're in this fight in the first place? We're joined now for an update on things by Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. He joins us now by phone from Toronto. Welcome to Counterspin, Brett Hartle.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, this is a multi-front assault, as I understand it, from the Trump White House on regulations relevant to the Endangered Species Act. What are some of the pieces of what's going on right now?
Well, sure. And it's important to understand, like you said, that the Endangered Species Act is a remarkably successful and popular law. It has saved 99% of the species under its care from extinction. And the way it has done it is through a series of rules and safeguards that have been in place for nearly 45 years. And the Trump administration released three separate related proposals that collectively really just take a meat cleaver to those safeguards, to the rules that have so successfully saved endangered species. So it'll make it harder to protect them, to protect their habitats. It'll make the protections they receive weaker. And like you said, it will also rubber stamp and streamline a lot of really dangerous projects, all in the name of benefiting special interests at the expense of endangered wildlife.
Well, here's the Washington Post quoting Fish and Wildlife Service Deputy Director Greg Sheehan. Quote, we are proposing these improvements, these are what they call the changes, we are proposing these improvements to produce the best conservation results for the species while reducing the regulatory burden on the American people, close quote. Now, there's no explication of that empty phrase, but the piece then quotes a lawyer for the conservative law firm, the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he says, quote, the modest reform proposed by the Department of Interior today could finally enable the Endangered Species Act to achieve both of its noble goals of preventing extinctions and promoting recovery of protected species. Relaxing regulations as a species recovers will reward property owners for their role in that recovery, creating a necessary incentive for landowners to restore and improve endangered species habitat, close quote. Well, I'm going to ask you to respond to the idea that weakening the act strengthens the act, but I want to say also it bugs me anyway that the issue is still presented in this some say others differ format. It's like an argument preserved in amber, you know, as though there's no evidence to consider this question of does protecting species kill the American dream or whatever.
Yeah.
So how do we parse this argument that we're hearing here?
Sure. And, you know, I mean, I think you're right. Kudos to the other side for really winning the rhetorical war in most of the media. You know, they make it seem like it's an even-handed debate and the people are split when, in fact, I don't think most people, even Trump voters, thought that gutting protections for endangered species was the reducing regulatory burdens that they had in mind. You know, first, it's important to understand that the Endangered Species Act has always not only incentivized good behavior on private property, rewarded private property owners as species recover, provided enormous flexibility to allow reasonable development to occur as long as we mitigate and then minimize the harm that we cause endangered species. But more broadly, I mean, I think it's important to really understand that when they talk about making the act work better, it's just code. It's code for them to basically say, we're giving a green light and a rubber stamp to things like drilling offshore and drilling in the Arctic and mining for coal everywhere. There's nothing reasonable or moderate within these proposals, for example, where they simply say, we are no longer going to protect critical habitat for endangered species that are harmed by climate change. And we're not going to assess the impacts of climate change on endangered species ever again. That's not even remotely reasonable. Reducing the protections for threatened species is basically what it's saying, like, well, if you were in the hospital and you were recovering from a bad injury or a bad illness, and halfway through we said, well, you know what? We're just going to, you know, get rid of your medications and, just assume that because you're on the right track today, it's just going to keep going well. You don't end a treatment for a serious illness halfway through because things are going well. You finish the treatment, you get yourself to recovery, and then you move forward. Basically, what we're going to see is hundreds of endangered species that were on the right track, moving towards recovery, moving back to healthy populations, get derailed and be sort of like stuck in limbo or purgatory for years to come.
Well, Obama did it too, is a popular parlor game. And it's important to see where there's a continuity of policy and impact, even if there's been an evident change in personality or in approach. Well, you've been working on this issue for years, including within Congress. Does what we're seeing now represent a break or an escalation or what? How would you differentiate this administration's actions on this issue?
I'd certainly be the first to agree that, you know, no administration is perfect and that the Obama administration fell short, too, in critical areas. But this is far more sweeping, what the Trump administration is doing, than any other president has tried before. It really just, it goes far beyond the realms of, you know, the reasonable policy disagreements that normal governments have when parties shift. So I think it's a pretty dramatic escalation. It certainly aligns well with what the Republican majorities in Congress are doing right now, which is relentlessly attacking every aspect of the Endangered Species Act under the same, you know, rhetorical guise of regulatory reform, when it really is just about rewarding special interests and the largest polluters and their sort of richest friends. So it's in some ways more of the same, but in some ways this is actually extremely dangerous and unprecedented, and hopefully, you know, the American people will speak out against it.
Well, I wanted to say about media, I don't think it's that they don't acknowledge that there's powerful corporate interests at work here. It just feels like they lend, and this is what you're talking about, the balance. It seems like they lend legitimacy to the argument that protecting species conflicts with business and with jobs. And I think partly they do that by painting it as a values thing. You know, it's elite and out of touch to care about, if not the environment, individual species. You know, we remember when spotted owl was just itself a punchline, you know. And then it's very salt of the earth to want to cut red tape and all of that. And I think some journalists, you know, who are the same ones going on about the heartland may buy into that when, if they talk to actual conservatives of a certain stripe, they'd hear something very different than the argument that they're kind of putting in a lot of folks' mouths, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of rhetoric and a lot of, you know, demagoguing and scapegoating that unfortunately happens to some endangered species. They become, unfortunately, you know, and wrongly, the target of a lot of anti-federal government feelings and sentiments because they're easy to demonize. And, you know, special interests learned long ago that it's probably better to villainize them than to try to explain the complexities of our, you know, supposedly free markets, when in fact there's many other reasons that, you know, drive a lot of these economic questions. So, you know, spotted owls, sage grouse, wolves have always been blamed for very complex problems, and they're not responsible, but they're easy to pick on. And unfortunately, the media buys into it sometimes. But the reality is, that, you know, we have over 1,800 endangered species in the United States. 99% have been saved from extinction. Many are on a path to recovery. And we have been able to do that for decades while also accommodating, you know, reasonable development. So it's not incompatible. And the reality is that healthy, thriving wildlife benefits people enormously, just as healthy environments do, because we depend on things like clean air and clean water and healthy wildlife to thrive as a society.
I just think even some conservatives are being misrepresented here, you know, even who would define themselves as conservatives who are actually conservationists as well.
Yeah.
Well, finally, we've been saying that people don't seem to accept these arguments. People support the Endangered Species Act overwhelmingly. What do you see happening over the next few days? What are you going to be doing, and what can folks be doing?
Well, so right now, these are all proposed changes to existing regulations, and that means that there's a public comment period. It's going to go on for 60 days till about late September, and any person, it's at your right as a citizen, to write or email and express your opposition or your thoughts about this. The government has to at least acknowledge them and respond. And, you know, we will be doing that. And, you know, if the Trump administration continues to push many of these changes, which are harmful to the Endangered Species Act and probably illegal, just like many of the other rollbacks that we are seeing across the board, you know, we will go to court, and I think ultimately we will prevail.
We've been speaking with Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Find their work online at biologicaldiversity.org. Brett Hartle, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot. Have a good week.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
In all our lives in the so-called information society, we do not know how our bodies react to heat. And planet Earth is erupting in heat waves, with tens of thousands dead at a time, with more to come, many more, as warming rules. In this program, you will learn how heat kills and your own risk. We'll also hear a warning from 15,000 scientists. That crested the serious newspapers for a few seconds, but it is a second warning to humanity. We'll hear from the man who started it. It all wraps up with a short chat with a young futurist about sponge cities. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Good luck. If you have a body and believe more heat waves will come, you need to hear this interview. We're going to explore new science with a title that is starkly clear, 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. In April 2017, I interviewed Dr. Camilo Mora. He led a team of 14 scientists from the University of Hawaii, Manoa. They concluded that somewhere between 2033 and 2070, nothing will be the same in a hotter world. That is when the Earth will get a whole new climate. Humans are already dying, as you know, by the thousands, even by the tens of thousands, in deadly heat waves. We don't know when that may become millions of deaths. In fact, until the work just published by Camilo Mora's team, nobody had studied all the ways our bodies react to excess heat. Camilo Mora is from the Department of Geography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, where he heads the Mora Lab. From Honolulu, Dr. Mora, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. A pleasure to be with you again.
Is your new paper a logical question arising from your earlier work on the arrival of a new hot climate?
Yes, and in fact, even after we published the paper that you're talking about, we did a second paper looking at heat waves that had killed people in the past. And what we decided was to investigate how many of them had happened, and we found close to 2,000 cases since 1980 when the conditions got to be too hot and people died. Some of these cases, as you point out, killed up to 70,000 people in a couple of weeks, like the one in Europe in 2003, that heat wave. It's amazing that killed 70,000 people. There was another heat wave in Russia in 2010, and that killed 15,000 people. There was a heat wave in Pakistan and India in the last 2 years that killed 4,000 to 5,000 people. So, and we found on that one paper about close to 2,000 cases, just like that, of people dying around the world because it got to be too hot. Now, after we published that paper, one of the things that was very intriguing to me was the fact that on all of those papers and all of those cases that we reviewed, it was very vague how people died during those heat waves. So everybody knew people died on those days, but why they died? And the reason why that became important to me is because most people is getting the impression that it's only the poor people, the elderly people, the one that had no money to buy an air conditioning, the people that are dying during this heat wave. So we decided to investigate how is it that people is dying, and we ended up reviewing the medical literature. We reviewed a lot of papers about how medically is that you die, and we found that when you put all of those pathways together, there are 27 ways in which you can die during a heat wave, and they can pretty much happen to anybody. So for me, it was just mind-blowing to find that there are so many of them, you know. I just expected to be maybe one or two ways in which you die during these heat waves, but finding out that there were 27 ways, it was just mind-blowing to me, because that just points out the fact that as a human, we are very delicate to heat, and unfortunately, the planet is getting hotter. So you get the combination of two terrible things coming our way.
Well, it is amazing. I mean, we learn a little bit about our basic organs and maybe circulation in school, and then we don't really know how heat is dangerous for us. And what you've just said stimulates another memory in me. In 2008, I broadcast a recorded briefing for congressional staffers about how smog kills. And it was Dr. Joel Schwartz, I think. He was Harvard's top pollution expert. And he said that we don't know how many deaths are caused by smog because the death certificates, they never say that. It's often listed as heart failure or something else. Do you think there's a similar lack of statistics and maybe underestimation of the number of heat deaths?
Oh, big time, big time. I mean, even on the developed world, there is not a sad diagnosis for when you die from a heat wave. Normally, obviously, at the end of the day, when you die from this thing, your heart stops, and most likely the diagnosis is that you had a heart attack. But it turns out that there were all kind of changes happening to your body and damages happening to a body that ultimately make the heart to stop. So obviously all of that gets a cluster within heart attack, and obviously there is a huge underdiagnosis of the number of people dying during these heat waves, because there is just no such a thing as a good diagnosis when people die from heat wave. Now, that's one of the things for the developed world. The things are obviously worse for the developing world. What we found on the paper in April about the heat waves that are killing people is that we found that all of these heat waves that are killing people are happening at mid latitudes, mostly developed countries like the United States, Australia, Japan, Canada, Europe, all developed countries. So for me, that was very intriguing. Is either this heat wave just killing the rich? Now, what we did find was that the climatic conditions that have killed people in those countries, those same climatic conditions are also happening on poor countries. So what that suggests to me was that in developing countries, these heat waves are also killing people. It's just that they don't have the resources to have the good research to find out how many of them are. So, yes, going back to your question where this is being underestimated, I'm confident that this is being underestimated not only on the developed world, but much bigger in the developing world.
Well, let's dig into the very good science in your paper about how our bodies really work when they get overheated. And I'd like to go step by step, Camilo, as you do in your very helpful press release about the paper. I've read the full paper, but that press release really helped me get oriented. And the first process we all experience is that blood flows towards the skin trying to cool us off. But what really happens there that is a risk?
So the risk that comes from when you get overheated, just like when you go for a run and you start overheating, your body starts generating heat and you need to expel the heat. So the body, what it does there is start making the heart pump harder, and it closes blood flow to many organs in a way so that all of the blood now goes to your skin, where it gets cooled down through the process of evaporation of your sweat. So the blood cools down and then it comes back in into your body cooler. Now, the problem when it's hot outside is that the sweat doesn't evaporate, then the blood comes back in hot. So the body makes an extra effort then to send even more blood to your skin as a way for it to cool down. By doing so, what it happens is that it deprives many organs of blood. And that's what is called ischemia. Basically, several organs start being deprived of blood. And what it does is that it creates these anoxic conditions on those organs, right? And when you have a lack of oxygen on those organs, then that creates all kind of chemical reactions there that are detrimental to that organ. The organ that is the most critical, interestingly enough, I found, was the gut. Obviously, you are hot, you just want to cool down the body. The first organ that it cuts the blood supply to are the gut, because you don't need the gut when it's pretty hot. But unfortunately, if the conditions are very long, the gut, the lining of your intestines breaks, and now all of the things that you had inside your guts leak in into your bloodstream. And what you ended up having is this massive contamination of your body with everything that was in your gut, into your bloodstream. And again, all of that, the result of the fact that there was just no blood getting into your guts. And that's one of the mechanisms that we found causes people to die during these heat waves. Basically, your guts just break, and that obviously is a cause for death.
But I had no idea that was happening. So how did you find that out?
Well, it turns out that there are many disciplines that have investigated that quite a lot. Like, for instance, people that do a lot of exercises outdoors, like sport people, military people, mining. These are jobs in which a lot of people have died because of excess heat. So the medical doctors had actually investigated that quite a lot on those cases. And that's how the medical literature is very rich on how people die from heat, because in certain jobs, the medical doctors had actually investigated that quite a lot. Unfortunately, when it comes to heat waves, we just lack the research to study that. But thankfully, we already know that well from other disciplines.
And what is heat cytotoxicity? Did you already cover that?
No. So another thing that happens, obviously the ischemia is one that can kill you. The other one that can kill you as well is what is called heat cytotoxicity. So when the blood comes back in hot, and obviously your body is generating more heat, the temperature of the body gets higher than the optimum temperature, which is roughly 37 degrees Celsius. So if it gets hotter than that, then basically you start cooking yourself. Think about like a sunburn. So many organs start getting damaged, physically damaged, but some other organs can also break Yeah, but just imagine this like a massive sunburn, and eventually your skin just peels off. So the same thing happens, but now inside your body. And what it does, of course, is that it starts helping the breaking of the membranes that maintain the structure of many of these organs. So the heart, for instance, starts breaking into pieces, and then it doesn't work as good in a moment when you need your heart very bad. So having a sex heat is pretty bad for your heart. It's also terrible for your lungs. Obviously, you start respirating more because you need more oxygen. And with this histotoxicity and you cooking your lungs, the lungs don't work as well. So many people start also suffering from lack of oxygen getting to to their bloodstream. And that is what is called histotoxicity, basically the time when the temperature is hotter than what the temperature that can be tolerated by yourself.
Does the immune system get involved?
We didn't find literature on that. We know that there is something called a shock thermal proteins, which is, again, just one response for the body to keep up with that heat. But our reading of that was that those are processes that normally take time to develop. But as for the immune system itself, we just didn't come across any specific paper talking about it, but that's not to say that they are not.
And then there's blood clots. Really, blood clots are a factor in heating?
Oh, big time. So what happens is when you break the lining of your guts, now the human body realizes that you are getting contaminated. So you have something that is called white blood cells, and they start attacking those contamination bacteria and food that now you have going through your bloodstream. And the way to kill it is just by creating coagulation around it, right? And now what you ended up having is a potential solution for healing the body, turning into something that can kill you. So that's one mechanism. The other mechanism is that you have these blood clogging proteins that, interestingly enough, are sensitive to heat, so they become overreactive. So everywhere they are, they just create coagulation wherever they are. Now, so that the clogging can kill you, right, because you ended up getting a clog, but the other problem that will happen is the fact that you will start running out of the clogging proteins, so that if you had a small cut, you can bleed to death because the body cannot clog it, because you pretty much use all of your resources of those proteins. So those cloggings are actually bad from both ends. They can kill you because they clog the blood, and when you run out of them, the lack of proteins that clog can also kill you, because you can have a danger of dying from an hemorrhage just because there is no clogging proteins left.
But I assume a process like that doesn't happen quickly. I mean, we're talking about a longer exposure to heat before all those systems could interact and kick in?
So that happens. It varies quite a lot, we presume, because there is not really research into this by individual. So there are certain individuals, for instance, the elderly, the isolated, people that is exposed to heat constantly, in which their temperature rises pretty fast, and unfortunately their body doesn't have the capacity to cope with it, so basically cooling down. So imagine of it like running a marathon. Yeah, so you can go and you can select 1,000 people to run a marathon, and most likely 10 of them will finish it. Most of us are just going to finish up. We are probably never going to finish it up. So the same thing goes during this heat wave. So you start stressing the body, and not everybody is going to be able to sustain it. And the extent to which these mechanisms start kicking in depends on how strong really you are at that moment. And, of course, many people is going to get filtered early on, and some of us might endure it at the end. So the answer to your question is that depends, obviously, on how good the body is at the moment when they get exposed to that heat.
But if we go to a sports game, we expect those teams to play, even though it's really, really hot. Although we had a couple of tennis players fall over in Australia, I think it was a couple of years ago, in heat there. Should we be closing games down if it's that hot, or should we even be exercising ourselves?
No. They do that normally. Obviously, doing exercise is not a bad thing, because what happens when you do exercise on a normal day is that the body can sweat and you feel the cooling. In fact, if you are doing massive exercise and you stop for a moment, you start feeling that the sweat starts evaporating, right? That's because the humidity is low and that evaporation cools you down. The problem is when you do that when it's hot, because basically there is no mechanism for the body to cool down. And that's when the thing becomes dangerous. And here in the United States, I have seen multiple times where referees had to stop the game for people to just go and get drink water and cool down a little bit, because it becomes potentially dangerous if you continue to be exposed to that extreme heat while doing exercise.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest from the University of Hawaii is Dr. Camilo Mora. He's the lead author of 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. Well, we're just getting started with this heating. We can stay inside with air conditioning, we think, as long as the power's on. But what about the 600 million people in India, for example, who do not have electricity at all? What are their prospects as global warming develops?
Well, first of all, I don't think the air conditioning is really a solution to this problem, yeah? Because imagine, let me just give you an analogy. There is I am a good friend with Mike Tyson, and Mike Tyson every time keep punching me on the face, right? So we're good friends, but every time he just keep punching me on the face. Now, my solution to that problem is to use protective gear on my face so I don't get, when he punched me, I don't feel the pain. Right, so the same analogy goes here with the air conditioning. We had a heat wave that is killing people, and our solution to it is just to buy air conditioning so it doesn't, we don't feel the pain. Personally, I would prefer the solution to for it to be not to be heat waves at all, just like in the case of my friend Mike Tyson. I would like him not to punch me at all. Yeah. So this idea that we are going to escape these dangers of this heat by buying air conditioning is fair game, but unfortunately, I don't think that's the best solution because at the end of the day, these heat waves are still going to be just as lethal outside. Now, but you point out a very interesting point, though, which is the fact that many millions, if not billions of people around the world just don't have the resources and money to buy an air conditioning, much less to pay for the electricity that it will cost. Now, that's for the developing world. Now, for the developed world, the problem is going to be the electrical grids because during those heat waves, the electrical wires cannot conduct electricity as good because it's pretty hot. To make matters worse, everybody is turning on their air conditioning. So it has been found in multiple cases in the developed world when these heat waves are happening and everybody turns on their air conditioning that the whole electrical grid collapses. Yeah, and obviously that becomes a potential death sentence for many people because you're in the middle of a heat wave and you cannot turn on your air conditioning. And again, that's another argument that I use to suggest that really what we need to do is to prevent these heat waves from happening in the first place.
I'll bet most Americans have forgotten about the Chicago heat wave of 1995. Over 700 people died in 5 days. They parked refrigerator trucks outside the overflowing morgues to hold them. And one factor in Chicago was fear of crime. Seniors died inside their rooms because they were afraid to leave a window open. So I guess social factors can be important in all this, too.
Yes, I mean, that's another big issue for the good and for the bad. Right now, for instance, in the United States, this past summer and the summer before, there were over 100 million Americans that were told to stay indoors because it was too hot outdoors. Yeah, there were warnings by the federal government that say you need to go indoors because the conditions outdoors are pretty lethal. So that's the reason why we are not dying so much. It's just because right now the government is becoming more preventive and people is becoming more aware of this. But again, that doesn't mean that the conditions outdoors are just not as lethal.
Well, we also had an Australian medical expert on the show saying that the nighttime temperatures can be critical, as well as the number of days of heat in a row, because somewhere we need time for the body's core temperature to cool down or we die. Did you encounter that factor in your study?
No. Yes, it is there, but specific information, we found only like maybe one or two papers about it. What makes this situation even more dangerous, especially on tropical places, is the issue of humidity. Right, so during the day, it's pretty hot because the sun is blasting right at you, right? So in places that are humid, obviously that heat evaporates the water. Now, at night, when the sun falls down, you still lack the heat from the sun, but unfortunately, as it gets colder, the humidity goes up because there is less temperature on the air. The temperature is colder. So what happens at night on many of these tropical places is that it's not necessarily the heat as much as it is the high humidity what then heats you at night. So you go from being hot all day long because during the daytime you get the high temperatures of the sun, and at night when there is no high temperatures of the sun, you get the high humidity of the evaporation and you still cannot cool down. So obviously this becomes like an endurance test that many people cannot endure because you just don't get a relief of it, not during the day, not during the night.
We mentioned seniors and people with medical conditions, but as you mentioned in your paper, babies and toddlers are really at risk during a heat wave. Why are their bodies more sensitive?
So on that paper, we actually make the case that this is something that could happen to anybody. Yeah, so obviously there's a much higher risk for this to happen to specific people like the elderly and the young, but that's not to say that healthy people like you or I or any young person is at risk from this. This can happen to even sport people playing outdoors. Now, but answering your question of the children, though, the reason why they are very vulnerable is because of their small bodies. The heat can get to them faster. So they heat up much faster than an adult will do simply because they're small bodies. Think about it. Like when you had a big potato and you want to cook it, you put it on the hot water, that big potato is going to take a long time for it to cook. Now, you put a small potato or you cut that potato in half, the big potato in half, that potato is going to cook much faster because the heat can get to the core much faster. So the issue is the same issue with children and with babies. It's the fact because their small body, whenever it's hot outdoors, that heat gets to them much faster than it will do to an adult just because of their size and volume.
Well, I'm sorry to ask this one, but we do need to face up to it. I'm wondering what it might feel like to be dying of heat. Would we even know that we are dying? I mean, we don't know we're at risk. Would we know that it's actually happening to us?
No. And in fact, most of the there is something called harvesting effect when it comes to heat waves, because you may still feel the heat, and these many of these physiological processes can be triggered, but you might not die right away. You know, you can die, for instance, with a broken liver, with a broken kidneys. You can live with that, and unfortunately, the death normally happen past the heat wave event, and that's what is called the harvesting effect, in which the mortality associated with these heat waves actually happen a few days, months, and at times years later after the heat wave, just because the organs got so damaged, they can still function, and so on, but eventually they will get you. So just going back to your question, it's just not safe to be on hot conditions for a very long period of time because it will trigger these mechanisms. Again, that's just not to be scared of heat, because normally the body has a very good defense to cool down from it. The problem is when you get exposed to it for a very long period of time, which happens during a heat wave, that you get exposed for two or three weeks of heat during these heat waves.
Well, you know, so far the world's only warmed about 1 degree C over pre-industrial times, and I'm having a hard time finding any scientist on the show who thinks we won't warm at least another degree during this century, and some say we will hit 3 degrees or more. Camilo Mora, given your study, what does this future look like?
Oh, no, this is not going to look pretty. Right now, this is the – I mean, that's just remarkable. I mean, it's I wish everybody in the United States and around the world will do a PhD on this to appreciate better the evidence and how bad this is and why scientists are so scared about this. You know, it's because when you look at the data and you study these cases, you realize how terrible this is. So as you point out, we are already heat up the planet by about 1 degree, and we found 2,000 heat waves since 1980 that had killed people. We found that 30% of the world's human population right now is exposed to deadly heat at least for 20 days a year. Now, what we are talking about is that if you fix climate change right now, the best we can, the Paris Agreement, even under the best-case scenario, you're still going to allow the planet to warm up by 1 degree more. So right now, even the most optimistic people in the world, when it comes to science, had agreed that the planet will still heat up by one more degree. So if you keep in mind that 30% of the world's human population is exposed to deadly heat already, imagine then what it will be when you allow the planet to warm up by one more degree. Of course, this is not to say that we shouldn't do anything, because if you don't do anything, then the planet will warm up by 4 and 5 degrees Celsius more, and that could be the end of it.
Indeed. I think people in industrialized countries remain confident that science and technology will protect them. They don't believe the electricity will go out for a month or two, as it did in Puerto Rico. They think the government will save us, or maybe the military. I feel like we're fooling ourselves in a really dangerous way.
Yes. So there is a psychological, actually this has been studied quite a lot, these psychological biases, that why is it that we don't take this more seriously? There is one of those biases that is called optimism bias. And basically what it points out is the fact that we normally, everybody thinks that bad things are happening. Obviously you see them on TV, on the news, and sometimes you might even see them, but you always think that that's just going to happen to somebody else. And that optimism bias is what is preventing people of taking action on climate change, because while we appreciate that might be bad, it's something that is going to influence somebody else. When it comes to me, then I will worry about it. Unfortunately, that optimism bias is just a matter of time until it eventually gets to you. And the example that I will give you is exactly what you are talking about, Puerto Rico, or the people in Texas, or the people in Florida that were struck, every one of those, by individual hurricanes this past summer season. this is a storm season. I bet that if you went to Texas a year ago, most of these people will tell you that climate change is just going to happen somewhere else. It was a matter of time until it came knocking at their doors, and now you lost billions of dollars on that estate. But thanks God there were not many lives lost, but the damages and costs were massive until eventually came and knocked at your door that climate change is real. So, again, we live under this optimism bias that this is just going to happen to somebody else until eventually gets to us. And at that moment, unfortunately, that optimism bias, unfortunately, what it's doing is delaying the solutions to fix this problem. And unfortunately, the longer we wait, the worse these things are going to be when they come.
So what are the next big questions for you, Camila Mora? What are you going to be working on?
So right now, as a scientist, I mean, you go and look at the science of this. We have thousands of scientists, hundreds of scientific papers pointing out how bad this is. Personally, I think that it got the time for us to investigate how to fix this problem. A lot of scientists are trying to tackle these solutions to this problem at the government level, which is okay, don't get me wrong. But then it's very fragile solutions, just like what you had in the United States here. For many years, we had President Obama, who is a person that say, yeah, we are going to try to fix this. But then out of the blue, we had a person like President Trump that says, I don't believe on this. And he just goes and closes all of the regulations in place to prevent this from happening. So personally, I don't think the solution is going to come from the government. I think personally, the solutions need to come from the people. People like you or me that start tackling this problem until it becomes a social norm in which every individual of our societies become aware of the footprint that we are having on our planet. And right now, that's one of the things that we are working hard on my lab, which is how do we ensure that people become aware of this footprint, the individual footprint, and what solutions are there so that every individual can clean up their footprint. Just like when you go to the beach, you produce garbage, but it's not like you're going to leave that garbage on the beach. You normally take it up and pick it up and put it on the garbage bin. So we want to do the same thing for climate change, that every individual, like you and me, we produce CO2, and figuring out the mechanisms for you to remove that CO2 from the air, not at the country level, not at the government level, but you as an individual. And that's one of the solutions that we are working on pretty hard on my lab.
We've been speaking with Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii, Manoa. He is the lead author of a new paper published in the American Heart Association Journal, which is titled Circulation, Cardiovascular Quality, and Outcomes. The title is 27 Ways a Heat Wave Can Kill You, Deadly Heat in the Era of Climate Change. It is an open access paper, so you can search for that title or find the link in my show blog at ecoshock.org if you would like to read it. Camilo, thank you so much for providing this important science. We need it.
Thank you very much, Alex. A pleasure to be with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Still to come, the largest ever warning from world scientists about our rapidly deteriorating environment. Then a little younger hope of ways to adapt to extreme precipitation events. You may have heard or not heard that the great city of Athens, one of the oldest in the world, was pounded by rapid rains recently, streets filled deep with fast-moving mud. It's just another story from the new climate age. But cities can prepare, as we'll hear. First, here is a short vignette I've prepared with the help of Tiny Hands on YouTube, the first voice you know too well. But then we travel to Bonn, Germany, where a panel of American coal promoters are giving a government-approved push to include coal as part of reducing emissions. They want to help with climate change. Until a number of someones speak up.
Oh, good. Thank you, darling. I didn't know what the hell happened there. I thought they were the enemy, but they're my friends. Oh. Coal is coming back. Clean coal is coming back. 100%. Thank you. I'm so glad they said it.
Today, I'm taking bold action to follow through on that promise. My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. Going to have clean coal, really clean coal, Going to have clean coal, really clean coal, really clean coal.
Of all CO2 emissions, oil 34 and natural gas 25. The chart.
Those coal protesters in Bonn sang for sanity. They sang for us. 25 years ago, the scientists warned us humans are heading on a trajectory towards environmental disaster. 1,700 of them, including most of the Nobel Prize winners alive at the time, issued the World Scientist Warning to Humanity. It was 1992, the time of the famous Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Well, now our situation is much worse. More than 15,000 scientists from 184 countries have issued the World Scientist Warning to Humanity a second notice. It was just published November 13th in the journal Bioscience, and it's being echoed around the world media. William J. Ripple is the lead author. Dr. Ripple is a distinguished professor of ecology at Oregon State University in the Department of Forest and Ecosystems and Society. He's also a pretty well-known expert in biology and ecology generally. From Corvallis, Oregon, Bill Ripple, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, hello. Thank you, Alex.
Please tell us about that first warning from the world scientists back in 1992.
Well, back in 1992, the scientists got together, over 1,500 of them, and evaluated where humanity stands in terms of the environment. And they concluded that the trends were not good back then. And they wrote up this amazing letter to humanity urging humans to change behavior and change course. So I ended up just happening along reading about their letter last February. And while I was reading it, I noticed that it has been 25 years exactly since they had written their document, and also that nowadays we have the ability to track environmental progress with these global data sets. So I thought, wow, it'd be interesting to chart it and see how we have done since 1992.
Well, that's a pretty scary process, really. I attended the Earth Summit in Rio in 92, and climate change, I knew about it, but it didn't stand out as much as things like air pollution and overfishing and just flat-out destruction of the ecosystem. You have to say that climate crisis has been one of the big shifts during these past 25 years.
Yes. In the 1992 document, they only mentioned climate change in passing because it just wasn't much of the conversation back then. So now when we plot our numbers with greenhouse gas emissions and the change in the surface temperature of the Earth, things are much different now, 25 years later.
Well, yes, I think the big turning point for me was 2007 when the Arctic sea ice melted back so badly. That was a shock to the scientific community as well.
Yeah, I've been watching the climate scientists make predictions based on their models. And it seems very commonly that the scientists underestimated either the speed or the magnitude of the changing climate.
Well, 15,000 scientists, that's a lot of people. How did this giant call-out by scientists get started?
Well, I wrote my letter to Humanity last spring and finished it by June. And then I was talking to a colleague, and I was saying, wow, I wonder if I should get some help and on this draft with some co-authors. And so I have several co-authors that helped me finalize the draft. But then before publishing, I talked to my colleague again, and I said, I wonder if we should try to get co-signatures on this by opening it up to other scientists. And at that point, he said, definitely, it'll have more power if you get others to sign on. So at that point, I just emailed the paper to 40 colleagues, and within 2 days, 1,200 scientists had signed. So at that point, I was just overwhelmed and astonished.
Well, that's the beauty of social media. We didn't have that back in 1992, and now things can really get rolling. I'd like to break this down a bit. You published 9 graphs of key indicators since 1960, and one of the simple things, the amount of forest cover on the planet has shown a steep decline. As a recognized expert in species, what does this forest cover drop-off mean for living things?
Well, forest is a very important habitat type on planet Earth. First of all, it provides for habitat for all types of other plants and animals, whether they're vertebrates or invertebrates. And we did have this 2.8% decline in total forest area over the last 25 years. That may sound like it's not a very high percentage, but if we keep losing our forest at this rate, we've lost a tremendous amount of habitat. And even maybe more importantly, these primary forests that are being lost to habitat destruction, more importantly, might be that we're losing a sink for carbon dioxide. So these forests store a lot of carbon, and it's just an essential habitat type to preserve.
And they're also a big part of our rainwater system and our water storage system. And your paper does show a huge drop in the amount of fresh water available for each human alive. Do we know, is that because the world population doubled since 1960, or is it due to water pollution, or what?
Yeah, we found fresh water per capita decreased significantly since 1992, about 26%. And we ran the numbers, and we attribute nearly all of that to the increase in the world population. So that's a major driver in the decrease in freshwater availability. But that said, at the same time, I would say that we have huge problems with freshwater habitat. This is a freshwater ecosystems is where a lot of the development by humans takes place. And this causes anything from alteration of stream channels to pollution in lakes and rivers. All types of activities go on along freshwater ways.
Well, again, Bill Ripple, you're a species scientist. What happened to biodiversity now in the last 25 years?
Yes, what we did is we plotted the abundance of vertebrate wildlife species since 1970, but also from 1992. We have a 28.9% decrease in the abundance of wild animals. Now, these are animals that are vertebrates, and this includes all types of species, including the ones that live in the oceans and the rivers and on terrestrial areas. So this variable is quite disturbing. That's a large drop-off just in the last 25 years.
Yeah, you know, many people assume our only risk is climate change. It is a big one, but if we could magically remove the climate threat from the world picture, I think we'd still be in big trouble, wouldn't we?
Yes, yeah, and that's what we show in our paper, that yes, climate change is significant, perhaps the most significant challenge that humanity is facing now, but we are also in the midst of a biodiversity crisis where many species of plants and animals are becoming rare, are becoming endangered, some are going extinct, and their populations are going down rapidly. So this we sometimes call a mass extinction event. You know, we've only had about six mass extinction events in the last 540 million years. So this is really a big deal. It's kind of like the canary in the coal mine. Once we start losing a lot of species, it does not bode well for humanity in general.
Well, we've talked about deforestation a bit and species loss and fresh water, and all those are partly the result of turning Earth into a gigantic pen for meat animals. What does this paper, with all its thousands of scientific signatories, say about the meat-driven agriculture?
Well, we did address that in the paper. We plotted the change in ruminant livestock for the globe since 1992. And ruminant livestock are the typically thought of as cattle, sheep, goats, domestic buffalo. And when we plotted that up for ruminant livestock, we found a 20.5% increase in their numbers since 1992. So now today we're nearly 4 billion ruminants.
Well, you know, I'm wondering, your paper does talk about renewable energy as one of the solutions, and I'm wondering, is that like the answer, a big part of the answer, a small part of the total answer? What's your opinion?
I think renewable energy is very important for the issues surrounding climate change. So we need to have a non-carbon future if in order to reduce emissions in future years. So renewable energy, I think, is a big part of what we need to do for mitigating climate change.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. William J. Ripple from the Oregon State University. He's here representing more than 15,000 world scientists who just issued a stark warning to all of humanity. You know, I think, Bill, part of the problem is that very few people or governments want to talk about any of this. I mean, cutting back on meat, that's un-American. We all want our private cars. We want to fly anywhere, anytime. Christmas is coming. We have to shop. It's not polite to talk about birth control or climate change at work, at parties, or anywhere. How do we break through those silences in time?
Well, one of the objectives that we're trying to achieve with this letter to humanity is to increase people's awareness of the magnitude of the problem. So we put into 10 very simple charts what the trends are for various environmental and climate factors. So most everyone will be able to understand these simple charts, and they can see the trends themselves. So I think our first goal is to increase awareness with the general public. And then, secondly, I think that's important that once we have this type of understanding, a broader understanding of the scope of changes that are happening to the Earth's biosphere, that maybe there will be a groundswell of people who put pressure on their governments and their political leaders to make changes that will help in sustaining life on Earth into the future.
Well, you've studied the impact of having or not having major predators like wolves around. Surely we humans are the super predators on this planet. Do you sometimes see this widespread destruction we're talking about in terms of your studies?
Yes. Well, one way I think about it is, you know, I work in Yellowstone National Park, and we look at the linkages between wolves and their prey, and then the plants that the prey eat, and then the species that use those plants that the prey eat, like it goes from wolves to elk to aspen to birds and so on. So what we're able to see there is the interconnectedness of nature. And you can take this a step further and think about the interconnectedness of the entire of ecosystems within the entire biosphere. So, and humans are definitely the super predator here. And the responsibility lies with humanity in terms of presenting a sustainable future.
You know, this crisis is no longer something I personally can leave to governments. I'm struggling to get myself to change. Yesterday, I found myself driving when I could have taken my bike, even though I know about climate change. So I'm wondering, maybe we need some sort of self-shame or some mechanism that gets each one of us to do our bit, what we really could do.
Oh, that's a good point. And what we're hoping to accomplish with our letter to humanity is an example, just like you give, that people start thinking about ways that we can provide incentives for individuals to change their behavior. So this letter is just an opening of a conversation, and we want a global debate and conversation about what can we do next. So we only wrote 1,200 words here, and we are not able to save the world in 1,200 words. We're just definitely starting the conversation.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up with that. That's a pretty good way of putting it. And I just want to tell listeners that this was published November 13th in the journal Bioscience. And you can easily look it up by just searching in any engine, World Scientists Warning to Humanity, a Second Notice. And I'll also put links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org, coming out every Wednesday. We've been talking with William J. Ripple, and he's from Oregon State University, and he's the lead author of that paper. Bill Ripple, thank you for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
In the summer of 2017, the heaviest rainfall in a century hit the German capital of Berlin. It was another of the extreme rainfall events striking around the planet. In Berlin, streets and buildings flooded, but it could have been worse. Berlin is making itself, well, it's trying to make itself into a sponge city. As climate disruption becomes real, China is planning on building 30 of them. I found that out from Chelsea Goad. If Bill Gates is building a new smart city or technology is emerging to move you 10 times faster, that is Chelsea Goad's beat. She is a science journalist and associate editor at Futurism.com. Chelsea, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is a sponge city?
So there's no single definitive exact blueprint for what a sponge city is. But generally speaking, a sponge city is a city in which technological measures are taken to reduce flooding specifically. So there will be rooftop gardens, extra planting. Oftentimes a main element of the building or creation of sponge cities is that traditional asphalt and concrete are replaced by much more porous substances so that you might be driving down the street normally, but if it were to flood, if there were a monsoon, that same material will be able to absorb, you know, 10, 50 times more water. So the general concept of a sponge city is literally a city that can soak up water.
Well, yeah, I know that the hard city phenomenon was partly what sunk Houston in Hurricane Harvey. They just kept building suburbs there, replacing surrounding fields, paved everything over, and people's homes have huge driveways. Some folks pave the whole yard to avoid all that mowing. It seems like we've kind of designed ourselves into a bad corner just as extreme rainfall events arrive. What do you think?
I completely agree. This is really happening. You know, the extreme flooding is becoming much more of an issue in more densely populated urban areas. That's why China is investing so heavily in the creation of sponge cities, because in more rural areas, you will have, you know, fields, farms that naturally soak up water. But in a city, it's much more difficult, and then it becomes much more treacherous and much higher risk. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that at the same time we're having such increased growth of urban areas, we're also having this severe increased risk of continuing extreme weather and flooding.
And since Victorian times, the old way of city design was just to keep building more underground pipes and carry all that water away somewhere. Of course, Houston, their water reservoirs totally filled up. There was no somewhere to put it. So I guess we're going to have to change away from that and just keep what we get.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to really rethink a lot of how we structure and build from a very elementary root level.
And I saw in a Bloomberg video that Berlin is doing a lot of green rooftops, and they also do swales, as they call them, where the water can kind of collect. I was starting to wonder, though, if you collect a lot of rainfall, doesn't that open it up for mosquitoes, or am I just worrying too much?
That is a definitive possibility, but that also depends on the climate of the region that you're in. So Berlin, you know, if they start collecting rainwater, I don't think overnight it's going to become a tropical ecosystem and malaria will run rampant. But it is something that 10, 20 years down the line might require more consideration, and maybe that won't turn out to be the most fruitful technology.
So your article is titled, China's Building 30 Sponge Cities to Soften the Blow of Climate Change. Are the Chinese planning to build 30 new cities, or are they going to retrofit the existing cities?
Currently, with existing plans, they're retrofitting existing cities. So they're taking cities that already have an increased risk of issues of flooding, so cities that are, you know, generally fairly populated or relatively urban, and they're outfitting them with different methods that, you know, would pertain to a sponge city. But, you know, again, each of them would do that in a different way, depending on the needs of the region.
Well, China has a lot of reason to get going on this. They were drenched with extreme rainfalls last summer, just like Berlin, and they had landslides and floods that killed more people. And according to The Economist magazine, the number of floods in Chinese cities has at least doubled since 2008. I wonder, you know, there's not going to be enough emergency funds to patch all this up. Maybe the world will experience kind of the Puerto Rico phenomenon where it takes a long time to recover. Do you think we can plan our way out of this, Chelsea?
I think the only way to plan our way out of this is really by drastically reducing emissions and taking a much more aggressive stance against the continuation and pressing on of climate change, because, you know, we're solving the symptoms. These are the symptoms of the illness, and the underlying illness here is climate change. And, you know, our world, the world that we've known, is changing more rapidly and more drastically than we really are equipped to handle at this moment. So unfortunately, these increased natural disasters are a symptom of that existing reality that we're already in. So, you know, that isn't something that we can circumvent unless we really get to the root of the issue. So unfortunately, we might be dealing with a lot more of that type of disaster until we really make some more headway.
Well, I agree, but we can try and make things a bit better. And one really cool aspect of sponge cities is that they can literally help cool down those urban heat islands. I'm wondering, I guess it's just the combination of water and plants that help cool the city down as the climate heats up?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of sponge cities, it really is that simple. When you kind of take an urban environment and you introduce those, you know, natural elements that kind of draw in the water, very literally, it naturally cools the local environment. And it's simple, but it works.
You write about the future as though we're going to have one, and it may even have some good things about it, and that's refreshing for my crowd. Do you think that humans are going to be able to adapt to climate change? You've sort of addressed this somewhat, but I mean, are you a more positive person or not?
I think I'm relatively optimistic about it. I think that humans are uniquely innovative. We'll find our way out of really any issue, but I think it's a matter of collectively understanding what the issue is and what needs to be done. Because individual efforts are incredible, but if the entire globe isn't working together, it's going to be difficult. So yes, I do believe that, you know, we can fight our way out of this situation. I don't necessarily agree with Stephen Hawking that within the next couple hundred years we'll have to completely leave Earth. but it is a difficult situation. It's not going to be easy.
Well, Chelsea, while we have you here, what is Bill Gates up to in Arizona?
Well, Bill Gates has found himself roughly 25,000 acres of land, kind of a straight shot to Las Vegas. And he wants to build a smart city, set up kind of like a regular city. I don't know if it's going to be a sponge city yet, but, you know, I could assume that those elements might be introduced. And from what is publicly understood right now, it's going to be almost like a testing ground for technology. It's going to be a regular working city with residential areas and offices and schools, but it's going to have introduced to it a lot of more futuristic technologies that we wouldn't normally see in our day-to-day lives. So we'll see what happens with that.
Well, hopefully it's not all run on Windows 10 anyway. your other persona, though, you're a musician. Chelsea, where can people find your music?
Well, my band actually just released our first studio single on Spotify. So the band name is Foxanne, F-O-X-A-N-N-E. And, yeah, we're really excited about it. I didn't know you knew that. That's very exciting.
Is that Queen of the Lost Boys? Is that the song?
Yes, it is. And it's the first off of our upcoming record.
I heard it on SoundCloud, and I like it. We've been talking about sponge cities and the future in these times of climate change. Our guest is futurism journalist Chelsea Goad. You can find her on Twitter at Chelsea_Goad, and that's spelled G-O-H-D. And you can get the latest at futurism.com. Chelsea, thanks so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
We've used up all there is. Please listen again next week to Radio EcoShock. Let's go out with just a small sample from Chelsea Goad's new release, Queen of the Lost Boys.
Call me Sun's Song. Call me Queen of the Lost Boys. It was me who was lost all alone. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
People who have organized within the church for years have seen the sea change.
Certainly people of faith and people who have a justice orientation see those connections and say, no, we shouldn't play such a negative role in perpetuating these criminal actions.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. We now turn to Germany, where human rights activists are fighting parliamentary and municipal crackdowns on Palestine rights activism and restrictions on speech critical of Israel. Writing for the Electronic Intifada in April, Annette Groth, a former member of the Bundestag, Germany's parliament, says that in January of this year, quote, the Bundestag approved measures with the stated goal of combating anti-Semitism resolutely. Yet a closer look at the measures indicate that a key target is the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, or BDS, movement. In June, Germany's Ruhr Triennial Festival reversed an earlier decision to disinvite the acclaimed Scotland-based group Young Fathers because it had refused to renounce its support for BDS and Palestinian rights. The group was targeted after withdrawing from last year's pop culture festival in Berlin over the festival's sponsorship by the Israeli embassy. The Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel has called for a boycott of this year's pop culture festival in mid-August in protest of the Israeli embassy's continued sponsorship. To date, six international artists have canceled their appearance in the festival in support of the boycott call. Meanwhile, human rights activists in Berlin are challenging a motion that was adopted by the city's municipal government describing the Israel boycott movement as anti-Semitic. The motion also conflates criticism of Israeli state policy with anti-Semitism. Recently, I interviewed Anna Esther Younes, an adjunct professor, journalist, and researcher of Islamophobia in Germany, about the Berlin motion. I began by asking her about how it passed and how it will affect Palestine rights activists.
That's quite of an interesting question. I think there's no short answer to it. The discourse in and of itself started most likely in the 60s and 70s already, but from the year 2000 onwards, with the introduction of a new citizenship right law, we see the anti-Semitism discourse emerging towards the Muslim community. I would say the people of color community, because today we can see that this is not just a racial discourse towards Muslims or Arabs or interchangeably everything that is Middle Eastern, but it extends now to Afghanistan, to Africa. It's literally a discourse that, after this new citizenship law was introduced, aims at finding new ways to manage a population that becomes more and more diverse on the one hand. And with that diversity, a lot of non-white and non-European cultures and thus also ideologies and worldviews settle in and grow up in Germany. And that is literally the answer to a new citizenship law. And then we see it basically full-fledged, or basically kicking off from 2008 and 2009 onwards with the first parliamentary demands or appeals to the government, to slowly but surely end up in a discourse as of today where refugees and Muslims are labeled as anti-Semitic, as well as the entire BDS movement.
What are the implications of this bill? How will it affect human rights groups in Berlin and also speakers, individual people who come to the city to talk about Palestinian human rights issues?
Depends on from what position you're speaking, I guess. I would say until recently, maybe until the 2010-ish around, you could be very critical as a Jew, as an Israeli, as a German Jew, as an American Jew. You could say things that would be today not acceptable anymore, even if it comes from Jews. But there was this time, let's say, when, you know, at least Jews had the possibility to enact a certain identity and subjectivity even if it would go against the German mainstream. So there was a certain taboo to not be anti-Semitic that would still work. That is over now. So we see Jews that are not, you know, as you would, I would say maybe not outrightly Zionist, maybe even anti-Zionist, or definitely against the occupation. Even if you're a liberal Zionist now, these days, you encounter problems. So if that is already, and in fact, Jews are being racialized again, one would definitely, or publicly racialized again. So if you're not this type of Jew that we want to see, the Zionist, white European Jew at best, then you are a self-hating Jew. And then there come all these definitions of what it means to be a Jew, again, from white German Christians, which is kind of, I mean, it's interesting, but yeah, that's what happens. But if that is happening already to Jews, imagine that the Palestinian community in Germany, which until recently, even before the refugee influx happened due to the war in the Middle East, Palestinians here were silent. And it's the largest Palestinian community inside of Europe. I mean, there are substantial communities, political communities in Paris, in England, in Italy, in Spain. It's a different discourse there. And they're politically active, also around BDS. That didn't exist here to that level even. So, yeah, it affects us a great deal. So the only people until today who could speak out on our behalf were Jews or critical Israelis. And today we see that going down the drain as well. I mean, it's, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of the crackdown on BDS activism and Palestine rights organizing in Germany and how the Israel lobby has worked to help repress the movement?
I'm not very big on the Israel lobby here because I think in a, maybe you would need to talk to somebody else about that, but during my research, I think it primarily comes from a German civil society. That's where its roots are. I'm not saying that there's no Zionist Israel lobby. Definitely not. There are a couple of individuals whose name we all know. But what I'm trying to say is they would not work or exist or even have that impact if there wouldn't be a certain substantial German support. I wouldn't even know, like, structural support to make that possible. You know, I mean, it's a few people of that Israel lobby, and in a different context, they would really not be that successful. You know, it's the structure that enables that success, and that is really a white German structure that likes that. In fact, I mean, that enables it and likes the arguments that they're hearing, because Zionism is in a way a very good way of projecting anti-Semitism not only into the past but also having this, you know, maybe comforting idea that there's a state where all the Jews are allocated. So, and it's a German invention anyways, a non-Jewish German invention. So.
We're speaking with Anna Esther Yunus. She's a researcher in Germany. Anna, not only is there a growing antipathy toward activists who fight for Palestinian rights, but toward international artists as well. Roger Waters of Pink Floyd said this week that the mayor of Munich has accused him of anti-Semitism because he's a very open supporter of the BDS movement and of justice for Palestinians. Several major bands recently pulled out of Berlin's Pop Culture Festival due to the involvement by the Israeli embassy in the festival. These all signal a major expansion of the international boycott movement by artists and performers. Can you talk about the significance of these major cultural figures standing up for the BDS movement, especially in Germany right now?
The significance of it, I mean, it's obviously significant. I think Germany is portraying itself willingly and proudly as a complete fool. Because those people are, I mean, honestly, the Young Fathers, I knew one song of them. I started Googling them afterwards. So, you know, bad press is good press too for journalists. So, I mean, it's just in a way they're fueling a sort of, you know, resistance with that, you know, which is, it's also funny in a way. It's completely idiotic. And it's not only that Roger Waters was accused of anti-Semitism from the mayor or by the mayor of Munich. literally every newspaper after his show took place on a weekend published entirely, I mean, horrendous articles, you know, basically writing about him being this, you know, Israel-hating, anti-Semitic person and la, la, la. And the most important fact is that the German broadcasting system, state-funded broadcasting system, comparable only to the BBC in England, before his concert took place, boycotted, decided to not air on TV or radio his show, right? So obviously it's Roger Waters, it's ridiculous. It's like boycotting Michael Jackson or Beyonce. I mean, it's just stupid. But the mere willingness, the mere audacity that you have a state structure, it's a state bureaucratic structure of culture that has the obligation to inform people. It's written in the Constitution, which is why they are publicly supported. Or in the law, not the Constitution, sorry. Decides to boycott a different opinion, thus violating, in fact, its obligations towards its own citizens willingly, is interesting. It's what can I say? I mean, they use boycott against the people that they say are using boycott as a racist means. It's just funny.
Finally, Anna, there was a statement published by Jewish Antifa Berlin, the anti-fascist group, which strongly rejected the Berlin resolution and warned that while it will affect the free speech rights of both anti-Zionist Jewish and Palestinian communities in the city, as you mentioned, quote, Palestinians clearly will, as usual, and by no coincidence, pay the highest price. How are activists in Germany addressing the repression against boycott campaigners, and how are they fighting back?
I think there are only two major groups in Germany fighting that discourse, and it's the Jewish Antifa and the BDS community. But then again, the BDS community doesn't reach that media attention, I would say. Or if they do, then in a negative way. And then there's the Jewish Antifa, which is a group located in Berlin, and that's it. And it's also primarily Israeli, and it also says a lot, I think. But yeah, there's nobody else. That's it. That's how it's impacting the structure. And I'm glad the Jewish Antifa exists. It's very necessary. But as I said in the very beginning, the time of kids' gloves for Jews in Germany is, I would say, to my mind, officially over. And everything goes from now on. I mean, don't take me wrong, but in a given structure of a democratic society where now neoliberal means of, twisting reality to the extent that mere facts are opinions and opinions become politics, that's where we're at. I'm not talking about the war or genocide, but we're really in a scary time where things appear to be a funny spectacle most of the time. Yeah.
Well, we're going to keep watching this very carefully, and I really appreciate you being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast. Anna Esther Yunus, she's a researcher of Islamophobia in Germany, an adjunct professor and a journalist. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you, Nora. Have a good day.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakut, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gretchen Borschelt of the National Women's Law Center, who examines Trump Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's disturbing record on reproductive rights and women's health care. Bartlett Naylor of Public Citizen, who talks about the Trump administration's effort to dismantle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and why his group opposes Kathy Kreniger's nomination to head the agency. And Amira Sequeira of National Nurses United, who discusses the launch of the House Medicare for All caucus and the political and economic issues involved in moving the U.S. to a universal single-payer healthcare system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Trump administration's hardline policy on Iran could disrupt nations and peoples across the Middle East, especially the fragile coalition government in Lebanon. The powerful Shiite organization Hezbollah won parliamentary elections by a slim majority in May, and Washington hardliners have threatened to cut off U.S. aid. Its parliamentary rival, a coalition backed by the United States and Saudi Arabia, meanwhile has unraveled, leaving its leaders to cut their own deals to ensure continued political relevance. U.S. influence in the region appears to be diminishing, while Russia, which along with Iran has backed the winning side in the bloody conflict in neighboring Syria, is on the rise, including in Lebanon. Diplomatic and political sources in Beirut say the U.S. has signaled to Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri that Washington would not have a favorable view if Hezbollah had an increased role in the next government. Hardliners close to the Trump administration have threatened to cut off military aid to Lebanon, while others want conditions imposed on U.S. aid to the country. Last year, Russia floated a $1 billion credit line with favorable repayment terms for the Lebanese government to purchase Russian arms and equipment for the Lebanese army. But the offer was scuttled after the U.S. and Britain threatened to pull their respective military assistance programs to Lebanon if Beirut accepted the deal. The Guardian newspaper reports that oil-rich Nigeria has overtaken India as the nation with the greatest concentration of extreme poverty in the world. There are warning signs that within the next 12 years, the African continent will be home to 9 out of 10 of the world's poorest people. According to researchers at the Brookings Institution, 87 million people live in extreme poverty in Nigeria, more than the 73 million in deep poverty in India. India's economic prospects have improved with rapid economic and job growth. The report says 14 of the 18 countries in the world where the number of people in extreme poverty is rising are in Africa. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, currently ranked third, is also expected to overtake India soon. Increasing poverty in Africa has raised concerns among development experts at the United Nations, where attempts to reduce extreme poverty were seen as a success under the Millennium Development Goals. Andrew Shepherd, director of the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network at the Overseas Development Institute, observed that the situation appears to be exacerbated in African countries due to poor governance, harsher effects of climate change, and ongoing military conflicts. Los Angeles is the first city in the U.S. that is attempting to protect bank employees from their company's high-pressure sales tactics, such as those that triggered the Wells Fargo scandal. Wells Fargo bank employees were pressured to open 3 million fake accounts that cost unsuspecting customers monthly fees. A new city ordinance signed by Mayor Eric Garcetti requires banks that accept city deposits to demonstrate that it doesn't link employee pay to quotas imposed for the sale of bank products. Wells Fargo whistleblowers who exposed the abuses at the bank helped launch the Committee for Better Banks, a project of the Communication Workers of America. In contrast to the rest of the industrialized world, bank workers in the U.S. do not belong to unions and are forced to meet sales quotas. At Santander, A Spanish bank with branches across the United States, big collection centers deal with customers who may have fallen behind in payments for car loans. There, bank employees are told to use high-pressure tactics to extend the loans, which force customers to pay more on the back end. Now, union strategists, including Stephen Lerner, who ran the Justice for Janitors campaign, have set their sights on unionizing Santander workers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, federal Judge Brett Kavanaugh, makes the rounds of Senate offices to meet with officials who will vote on his confirmation, the Democratic Party and nonprofit groups representing a diverse set of constituencies are also gearing up to fight the nomination. One important constituency is women, against whose interests Kavanaugh has ruled many times, from reining in abortion rights to restricting access to birth control, to discriminating against women workers. According to one academic analysis, Kavanaugh, if confirmed, would be the second most conservative justice on the court, to the right of Neil Gorsuch, Trump's previous appointee, and close to the radical right views of Clarence Thomas. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center in Washington, D.C. Here she outlines some of Kavanaugh's past court rulings that don't portend well for women's rights in a variety of areas. Judicial views he would likely carry with him if the Senate confirms the judge to take a seat on the nation's highest court.
Obviously, the right case would have to come along that would ask the court to revisit or give them the opportunity to revisit the Roe versus Wade decision. But we know it's not just hypothetical because cases are working their way through the lower courts. This has been a deliberate strategy of the anti-abortion movement to pass laws in the states that restrict or undermine access to abortion because they want to get a case before the court that would present that court with the opportunity. So there are a number of cases working their way through the courts right now that could get to the Supreme Court and give them that chance to overturn Roe. And if the court were to take that up and were to decide that Roe versus Wade is no longer law of the land, we know there are at least 20 states that are poised to seek to ban abortion immediately after that. There are a number of states across the country that have either their own constitutional protection for the right to abortion or that have some kind of state law that protects access to abortion. But it's really important to remember that if the Supreme Court were to overturn Roe versus Wade, then there would be no backstop in the Constitution, and the Congress and the President could sign a nationwide ban on abortion. So it wouldn't just be up to the states. And if Congress and the Trump administration, who would be interested in doing it, did that, then whatever a state wanted to do wouldn't really matter because there would be a nationwide ban in place.
Gretchen Borschelt, do you have other concerns about Judge Kavanaugh joining the Supreme Court apart from concerns around abortion rights?
Brett Kavanaugh has a really dangerous record when it comes to a range of women's issues. So on birth control, he has voted to allow employers' religious beliefs to override a woman's right to insurance coverage of birth control. So we're very concerned that he doesn't see that birth control is a fundamental right and that a woman's decision to use birth control deserves respect and should not be decided by her employer. That's one thing we're keeping an eye on. The other is that we know Judge Kavanaugh has been critical of the Affordable Care Act, and Trump promised to only appoint justices who would gut the Affordable Care Act. This is a priority for his administration. And so we're very concerned that if a case about the Affordable Care Act were to come before the court, Justice Kavanaugh could decide that it's, you know, it's not the law of the land anymore, or could decide to try and gut it and allow insurance companies to go back to some of those practices that really hurt women. Insurance companies used to charge women more for the same coverage as men. They used to deny coverage to women because of pre-existing conditions like having been pregnant or having had a cesarean delivery. Those were all practices that ran rampant before the Affordable Care Act came into place. So any backsliding on that could leave women's health in dire straits. We also know in employment discriminations, Judge Kavanaugh has cited against employees time and time again and read non-discrimination protections really narrowly, deferring to employers' arguments for why they're treating workers differently. So I think for women in the workplace, Judge Kavanaugh poses a real threat. And then we also know he's really shown a willingness to restrict students' rights in schools, particularly rights of students with disabilities, and that's a women's issue too. So across the board, what we know of his record is very, very concerning for women's rights, for workers' rights, for students' rights. And I think there's going to be more to come to light as we get more of his record exposed and we get the documents released.
When you talked about the birth control restrictions, was that the Hobby Lobby case?
So it was a case after Hobby Lobby. These were nonprofit organizations that wanted to refuse to participate in the program by which they were allowed to not provide birth control coverage, but they had to notify their insurance company to say, we don't want to provide coverage, insurance company, and then the insurance company still had to make sure women got that coverage. It was a deal that the Obama administration gave to nonprofit organizations who had religious objections to birth control. And Judge Kavanaugh said, nope, even telling these employers that they had to, you know, do this process and notify their insurance company, that in and of itself was a violation of religious belief. Because in their view, by telling the insurance company that they wanted out, they were still ensuring that women got the coverage they objected to. So they said, that's a trigger. And we don't want to trigger this coverage being given to women. And so Judge Kavanaugh would have just let them out of it completely, and the women wouldn't have got the coverage they needed.
But his side lost in that case?
That's right. He dissented, and he was an outlier there. His court, the other judges on his court, decided otherwise. They said, no, this is not a violation of religious liberty. And seven other courts that considered the case, they decided the same. So he was really an outlier with that decision. Judge Kavanaugh is not the nominee we need, and we really need a nominee who's going to commit to upholding women's constitutional rights, including the right to abortion. And we're encouraging people to make that known to their senators, to ask them to commit to that standard.
That was Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center. Find links to news about opposition to Judge Kavanaugh's nomination and groups engaged in the fight to preserve reproductive rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, the Consumer Financial Protection Board was created to protect consumers from unfair, deceptive, or abusive practices and take action against companies that break the law. The CFPB, as it's known, also arms people with information they need to make smart financial decisions. Yet when the Trump administration took office in January 2017, they moved quickly to dismantle the agency. CFPB acting director and Trump's director at the Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, pulled back the Bureau's investigation into the massive Equifax data breach and dropped an investigation into a payday lender who donated to Mulvaney's congressional campaigns. On June 9th, Mulvaney fired his 25-member advisory board en masse. Despite the fact that the Bureau was created to protect consumers from predatory banking and lending practices, under Trump and Mulvaney, it's clear that their top priority is to close down the agency and protect Wall Street fraudsters. To that end, President Trump has nominated Kathy Kreninger, who works with Mulvaney at OMB, to become the next director of the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Not surprisingly, opposition to Kreninger is mounting, but Democrats in the Senate likely don't have enough votes to stop her confirmation. Your reporter spoke with Bartlett Naylor, financial policy advocate with Public Citizen, who talks about the Trump administration's effort to dismantle the CFPB and explains why his group opposes Kathy Kreninger's nomination to lead the agency.
Some of the most conspicuous problems have to do with debt collection and payday loans. These are the high interest rate loans. The CFPB has substantial authority under UDAP, Unfair Deceptive and Abusive Practices. Mulvaney has either terminated investigations or sharply reduced the restitution that consumers might bring. So, for example, last week he announced a penalty for a company of something like $500,000, but the restitution, which was millions, tens of millions of dollars, he eliminated. So in other words, the company may have enjoyed ill-gotten gains, but it doesn't have to give those back to the actual victim. Again, under Obama's director, they had returned some $12 billion to nearly 30 million consumers.
Tell us about Kathleen Kreniger, Donald Trump's nominee to become the next director of the Consumer Financial Protection Board.
The appointment of Kathleen, or the naming of Kathleen Kreniger as the director adds to the insult. She has zero background in finance, zero background in banking, zero background in consumer protection. She is about 43 years old. Currently, she is a lieutenant for Mick Mulvaney at the Office of Management and Budget. Before that, she worked for the Department of Homeland Security. In addition, she has worked as a staffer for a number of United States senators. But notice in all of that, I'm not saying anything about working for a bank, working for a consumer protection agency. The word finance doesn't come up. Her confirmation hearing last Thursday before the Senate Banking Committee went into subjects where she was expert. At OMB, she oversees five or six departments, two of which oversaw the CAGE children deterrent policy. That's the family separation policy at the borders. And while she's being touted as a manager, she declined to offer any details about her responsibility or even her opinion about the morality of separating children at the border to serve as a deterrent, a message to people further in Central America, for example, who might contemplate bringing their families out of as refugees to the United States. She was asked by Elizabeth Warren, by Jack Reed, by Senator Schatz, what's her opinion of that? And her response to that and every question was, I appreciate your question, but it's inappropriate to offer an opinion.
Although the Republicans control the Senate, is there any chance that senators might reject Kathy Kreniger as the next head of the CFPB?
I think there is a chance and a reasonable chance. Based on the questions, I did not hear any support. I heard all concern by all of the Democrats on the committee. If her nomination clears with complete Democratic opposition, it is possible, as you know, that one or two Republican senators might oppose her. It's clear that both the border, the CAGE children deterrence policy, the Puerto Rican issue are problems that cross the political lines, that there are certainly Republican senators that understand that these are woeful examples of mismanagement. If she is being touted as somebody who, while she lacks any financial consumer protection background, she's an expert manager, then at least one or two of these Republican senators might be convinced that this is not the right person.
That was Bartlett Naylor, financial policy advocate with Public Citizen. Learn more about the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and opposition to Kathy Kreniger's nomination to lead the agency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the Trump administration's continuing effort to repeal or weaken the Affordable Care Act, triggering steep increases in health insurance premiums across the country, a majority of Americans appear ready to embrace what virtually all other industrialized nations have, a universal health care system that covers all citizens. To that end, Democrats in the House of Representatives announced the formation of their new Medicare for All caucus on July 19th, which was launched with more than 70 supporting members. The caucus will back pending legislation, H.R. 676, which is the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, and they'll closely examine specific policy components necessary to implement a single-payer system in the U.S. The Medicare for All Act currently has 122 co-sponsors in the House. A public opinion poll conducted in March by the Kaiser Family Foundation, a nonpartisan health policy think tank, found that 59% of those surveyed supported a Medicare for All healthcare system in which all Americans would be covered by health insurance. Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign, where he advocated for Medicare for All, did much to popularize universal healthcare alternatives to the current failing system. Your reporter spoke with Amira Sequeira, legislative advocate with the National Nurses United Union, who talks about the launch of the House Medicare for All caucus and the political and economic issues involved in moving the U.S. to a universal single-payer healthcare system.
This was really a historic moment in the fight for a Medicare for All single-payer healthcare system in the United States, because it was the first time that a group of members of Congress have come together in an organized fashion to say, we believe a single-payer Medicare for All system is the solution to the healthcare crisis in this country, and we are going to work together to achieve it. So for Medicare for All single-payer activists across the country, this was really a groundbreaking day. And to add to that, when the caucus was introduced, there were 66 members in the caucus. We are now at 74 members of the House of Representatives who are in this new Medicare for All caucus, which is a big percentage of the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives. And so these members are going to be coming together to really dive into the details of a single-payer system, how we make this work, how we improve Medicare so that we can improve it and expand it, so it provides the health care that every person living in this country needs. So it was a really exciting day. We're very grateful to Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, and Congressman Keith Ellison, who are serving as the co-chairs of this caucus and help bring these now 74 members together to work together to achieve Medicare for All.
Amira, can you describe the broad outlines of Medicare for All and what it would look like, given the fact that people around the country are more or less familiar with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which has not performed as many people hoped, so many people left behind. And of course, there are rising costs because the system, Obamacare, is still rooted in the private for-profit health insurance industry. And then, of course, you have the Trump administration attacking the good things that the ACA did in so many ways that it's a shadow of its former self. And even then, in its perfect form, it really wouldn't have met the needs of everybody in the country. But do tell us what Medicare for All would look like.
While the Affordable Care Act has allowed this country to make huge gains in making sure that more people are insured, especially through Medicaid expansion, even in its perfect form, it could not have allowed for the low-cost, universal health care that we need. So a Medicare for All system is a single-payer system. It would be similar to the health care system in Canada. And we're lucky because we already have a single-payer system in this country, and that's the Medicare program. So right now, Americans over the age of 65 get health insurance through the Medicare program. And so the way single-payer works is it's basically a socialized insurance model where everybody is in one basically insurance system through Medicare. And what that means is then the Medicare program is the single payer for the healthcare system. So what we would do is, in a Medicare for All system, we would take the current Medicare system, we would improve it so it would include things like dental coverage, optical coverage, prescription drug coverage, and we'd expand it to include everybody in the country, not only people over the age of 65. So every person in the United States, no matter your race, gender, where you live, where you're from, would have quality therapeutic healthcare. You could see any doctor, you could see any hospital, any specialist. You'd show up with your Medicare card and you would get the care you need without a copay, without a deductible, and without a premium.
With the launching of this Medicare for All caucus in the House of Representatives, does this signal that one of the two major political parties in this country is about to fully advocate for a single-payer system in the United States? And I guess I'm looking towards 2020 when the national conventions occurred. Will the Democratic Party, in your view, adopt Medicare for All as an important part of its party platform?
The Democratic Party would be crazy not to. Certainly, the launch of this caucus signifies a huge shift. The incredible support on the federal bills, with 122 members supporting the bill in the House and 16 members supporting the bill in the Senate. But it is up to us, it's up to regular people to hold those members of Congress accountable. It's not enough to just show support by signing on to a bill. You need to fight for this change. And hopefully we will see a new and improved progressive Democratic Party going into the 2020 elections. You know, I think this is an incredibly exciting time for Medicare for All because there are literally hundreds of people running for office in the midterms who are running on Medicare for All. And they're running on Medicare for All because they believe in it, right? Because it's what everyday people in this country want. And that's what the Bernie campaign showed us. When Senator Sanders ran in 2016, the excitement around his campaign because of the Medicare for All proposal, along with a few others, it's undeniable that this country wants to see a shift to Medicare for All. So I think this is a really exciting time. I'm really looking forward to hopefully seeing a lot of people elected in various offices, locally, statewide, and federally, who support Medicare for All.
That was Amira Sequeira, legislative advocate with National Nurses United. Learn more about the efforts to expand Medicare to a universal single-payer healthcare system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPP in Athens, Georgia, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KYAQ in Newport, Oregon, and more than 60 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Paradox of Liberty. Lest we forget, this chapter is about the great white Aryan Anglo-Saxon civilization's commitment to follow the sun, civilize the world, and help all the unfortunate savages find Jesus. One of those civilizing Anglos was, of course, Thomas Jefferson. In fact, the Smithsonian installed an exhibit dedicated to the greatest gentleman slave owner of the United States, entitled Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, Paradox of Liberty. Author Leah Caldwell writes, after visiting the exhibit, "It doesn't bode well that if you enter the Jefferson exhibit not knowing what slavery was, you might come out thinking it was an intensive training program for highly skilled craftsmen." Nevertheless, Edward Rothstein's review in the New York Times is a classic example of the establishment's fourth estate protecting the status quo. Sit down, don't rock the boat, when he actually criticizes the exhibit for stating that Jefferson's Declaration of Independence did not extend life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to African Americans, Native Americans, indentured servants, or women. Rothstein wrote that this pushed too far, and that each of those cases needs different qualifications and examinations. They distract from the subject. In his autobiography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, the great social reformer remembers his first thoughts regarding his condition. In fact, his reflections on his own experiences offer an appropriate response to Jefferson's cheerleaders. Why am I a slave? Why are some people slaves and others masters? Was there ever a time when this was not so? How did the relation commence? Once engaged in the inquiry, I was not very long in finding out the true solutions of the matter. It was not color, but crime, not God, but man, that afforded the true explanation of the existence of slavery. Nor was I long in finding out another important truth, viz., what man can make, man can unmake. Here's another answer for those who like to contextualize about those masters who own, subjugate, and crush other human beings. It's never been considered okay to own another soul, unless, of course, you're modeling yourself after Satan. Remember, this wasn't during the Lower Paleolithic period. It was during the so-called Age of Enlightenment. In his essay, Jefferson's Crime, Not Mitigated by the Standards of Time, journalism professor Robert Jensen frames Jefferson's blameworthiness. Certainly Jefferson was familiar with Paine and the arguments against slavery. Certainly Jefferson was aware of the existence of the idea that all humans had an equal claim to liberty, and the argument that Africans should be considered human in these matters. Certainly, there were many different ideas about the institution of slavery and racism in play at the time. So we're not judging Jefferson by the standards of our time when we point out the way in which he employed racism to justify the barbarism of slavery. We are acknowledging that others in Jefferson's time, including such notable figures as Paine, articulated anti-slavery and anti-racist principles at the same time that Jefferson was, in 1781, writing in his Notes on the State of Virginia about the natural inferiority of blacks. Discussing the night side of Jefferson's legacy in the radio documentary American Icons, Monticello, American artist Myra Kalman suggests, if you want to understand this country and what it means to be optimistic and tragic and wrong and courageous, you need to go to Monticello. Tragic and wrong, for sure. Monticello. Jefferson's neoclassical Virginia brick villa stoically perches above 5,000 acres of rolling green hills, his plantation once tended to by hundreds of African slaves. From Jefferson's divine resting place, vistas stretch forever, and the Blue Ridge Mountains loom to the west. Monticello is a popular tourist attraction where Jefferson's slavery component is, for the most part, whitewashed down the hillside where it flows to the Ravana River, which connects to the James River, past other sprawling Virginia estates that should rightly be categorized as America's colonial terrorist camps, also known as plantations. It's as if we've been erased, observed one African-American visitor. The iconic architectural element of Monticello is the dome structure that towers above all else on his celestial home. Many believe that dome to be nothing more than a stately aesthetic element, but factoring in Jefferson's obsession with African slaves, actual testimony from his slaves, and an architectural concept called panopticon, a darker, more deviant purpose emerges. Quote Bob Dylan, "All along the watchtower, princes kept the view, while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too." Lucia Cinder Stanton, Monticello's senior historian, envisions Monticello as a panopticon with Jefferson the all-seeing at the top. He could see everything that was going on. Jefferson's library contained a copy of a book called Panopticon that outlined a new and controversial prison design that called for circular cells surrounding a central watchtower. Inmates would be unaware if they were being observed. At least two former slaves talk about Jefferson with his telescope, watching enslaved people at work, Stanton reports. So this whole concept of surveillance from his central place on the apex of the mountain came through the oral tradition. He could see out, but nobody could see in. Equipped with his telescope, this warden in a powdered wig would gaze down from his heavenly dome, tracking his enslaved labor force on Mulberry Row or in the fields or wherever forced labor took them. The enlightened Jefferson kept meticulous records of almost everything associated with his life. Two subjects stand out, vegetables and slaves. Novelist and Professor Jamaica Kincaid, with regard to lettuce, cabbage, carrots, cucumbers, and peas. The garden book has details of the things he planted, the food he planted, but it looks as if it just falls magically at the table. So he'll say, peas were planted. 6 weeks later, peas appear at the table. There's no involvement of labor. There's no soil at all. It's as if it's eaten. It doesn't have any evil in it. But when it comes to the checklist of Negroes owned, as calculated by Jefferson, Kincaid says, the farm book, on the other hand, is all evil. Very similar to his book about peas, corn, beets, and other vegetables, the farm book is a painstaking record of the human beings Jefferson owned. Betty, Martin, Thenia, Critta, Sally, Johnny, Daniel, Molly, and so forth. Sinister? Yes. Evil? Absolutely. More fairy tales about America's founders? Of course. Here's how the Monticello website heralds the bullshit. Monticello was home not only to the Jefferson family, but to workers, black and white, enslaved and free. Workers? Jesus Christ. American bullshit runs deep. Jefferson historian Joseph Ellis underlines Monticello Tom's warped sense of his Teutonic responsibility. Jefferson argued that one of the reasons that he couldn't free his slaves was that once freed, the blacks would intermarry with the whites and would dilute the pure Anglo-Saxon race. Well, he's fathering children by Sally Hemings, and some of them look almost purely white. And again, you get a Faulknerian scene. He's eating dinner, and he's being served by a slave who happens to be his own son. You've been listening to excerpts from Murder Incorporated, Empire, Genocide, Manifest Destiny, Dreaming of Empire, Book 1. It's written by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. Outlets cover U.S. President Donald Trump so much that CNN, for example, should be called TNN, Trump News Network. From morning to night, the scribblings, screeds, and paranoid fantasies of Trump fill the air like a rotten miasma. It's Trump, Trump, Trump all the time, a hurricane of curses and insults, enough for all. Fueled by ego and excess, it's a gas attack in a war against all he deems enemies. I must ask you, aren't you tired of it? Doesn't it seem like he's been there forever? Doesn't it seem like he'll never leave? Curses, insults, lies, and idiocies assault the ear, the mind, the air, the nation. Trump's America is a nation of madmen and a nation of mean men. Babies are snatched from parents for cheap political points. This nation, born of immigrants, hates all new recent immigrants for being too brown, too poor, too Spanish. And as hatreds bubble like split pea soup, the nation falls into a new low funk. I call it Trump fever. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour Summer Series. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs broadcast produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation, in partnership with the Center for Research on Globalization. Our shows air on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States and are podcast at the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we air a talk by Michelle Chalcedovsky on the globalization of war. The talk was delivered in Regina, Saskatchewan on June 8, 2018, and organized by the Regina Peace Council. Professor Chalcedovsky argues that the attacks of September 11, 2001 triggered a hegemonic project by the U.S.-NATO military apparatus, which has seen military operations deployed in every region of the planet. The global war on terrorism has been coupled by covert intelligence operations, economic sanctions, and the threat of regime change, all while nuclear weapons have been normalized as legitimate arsenal for use in conventional war theaters. Professor Chalcedovsky also maintains that this diabolical agenda, as he calls it, is made possible by a compliant media and co-opted anti-war movements which misrepresent the U.S.-NATO foreign policy agenda. As he explains, there is no sustained questioning of the motives behind the war on terrorism or the doctrine of humanitarian intervention in countries like Libya or Syria. Professor Chalcedovsky's presentation is based on research he compiled in a 2015 volume entitled The Globalization of War, America's Long War on Humanity, which is available through his website, globalresearch.ca. Professor Chalcedovsky is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal, and editor of Global Research. He is the award-winning author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty in the New World Order from 2003, America's War on Terrorism from 2005, Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War from 2011, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity from 2015. Here is Professor Chalcedovsky speaking to the Regina Peace Council on June 8, 2018.
The title of this, of my lecture tonight, was called The Globalization of War, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. Now that might seem to be a rather unusual title that I would list those four countries. I list those four countries because the United States is involved in World War III scenarios, which go back at least 10 years. We're not privy to everything which has been done within the U.S. military. But in 2007, the Pentagon had an exercise which was called Vigilance Shield. And it was, in effect, a scenario of a Third World War. And it was the United States of America against four fictitious countries, each of which were called Churia, China, Rubek, Russia, Birmingham, Iran, and Nemazi, North Korea. And this is a very detailed simulation of what would happen. Now, the fact of the matter is that those four countries are absolutely strategic for the following reason. They are non-compliant. They are exercising their sovereignty, and they are refusing to abide by U.S. foreign policy. That's the only reason that the games were in relation to those four countries. But once you understand the strategic importance of those four countries, you get a better understanding of the logic behind this military agenda. It's a global military agenda. It is not a sequence of separate operations. It's very well coordinated. There's a roadmap, and that is understood. I could say that in the year 2000, prior to the inauguration of George W. Bush, the project of the New American Century, which is a U.S. Washington-based think tank, published a report where they acknowledged a number of concepts. First, they said the United States will wage simultaneous, large-scale theater wars in different parts of the world. And this was put within a military framework. There was no justification to these wars. We will wage simultaneous theater wars in different parts of the world. And that was part of what they called the long war, okay? The long war against humanity, which is the subtitle of my book. But the term, the long war, is a Pentagon concept. But to get back to the PNAC's concept of the long war, they have, one, the statement with regard to simultaneous theater wars, and then there's a statement which pertains to what they call constabulary functions. Now, constabulary functions doesn't mean necessarily theater wars, but it might mean sending in special forces, regime change, a whole series of interventions, intelligence ops, economic sanctions. But the constabulary functions were really formulated as a military concept of policing countries through military and non-military means. And then the third, which is included in this list, is the revolution in military affairs, which essentially means developing new capabilities in the production of weapon systems, of advanced weapon systems. And mind you, that was really largely in support of the U.S. military-industrial complex and the large corporate conglomerates which receive these multi-billion-dollar contracts from the Pentagon. So that is the background which currently prevails and which is important to understand what's going on in different parts of the world. And the war in Syria is very much linked to the next stage, which consists in threatening Iran. There is a roadmap. This was based on statements that General Wesley Clark made several years back, where a certain number of countries have been identified, Libya, Syria, Iraq, and so on. But in any event, this is a war without borders. It is a war of conquest. But to sell this to the public, you have to have quite a big army of media disinformation, propaganda, where you actually present war as a peacemaking undertaking. Okay, and anybody who contests that, of course, is a conspiracy theorist. So, but the logic, the explanations to justify this war inevitably are based on lies. You can't do it otherwise. We're not waging a war of conquest. We're waging a war with a view to restoring democracy. We are going after the terrorists who are threatening our way of life, and so on and so forth. The fact that those terrorists are sustained and supported and financed by the U.S. military, by Saudi Arabia, by the Western Alliance, is not something that you're going to read necessarily in the mainstream media. Although you have enough information in the mainstream media to connect the dots. Those terrorists are financed, trained, and they have Western military advisors embedded within, and of course they have the NGOs who are involved, as well as the media, in falsifying the truth. So what's happening in Syria today is certainly not a civil war. It is an insurrection whereby Al-Qaeda-affiliated entities, as well as ISIS, Daesh, are used as a means to destabilize and destroy a sovereign country. And this is not something which is acknowledged by the mainstream media. They will say Bashar al-Assad is killing his own people, the rebels are there, you know, and representing various religions, etc., within, well, essentially Sunni versus Shiite and Alawite. Of course, they never mentioned the fact that the cabinet of Bashar al-Assad is largely made up of Sunnis, and it just so happens his wife is a Sunni. Okay, does that mean he's going to go out and kill his wife? Okay, but you won't see this kind of logic. You won't. I spent 2 months in Syria before the war broke out, and it's a country of tremendous tolerance, religious tolerance. There was no sectarian conflicts whatsoever. There may have been political conflicts, but what the media describes is the clash of ethnic groups and religions and so on and so forth. But in large part, these clashes are engineered, and they're engineered by the Western powers. And the plans to intervene in Syria predate, of course, 2011, when the war broke out. Now, I think we have to also understand the broader implications, as well as the economic and social implications of this military agenda. I think we must understand, first of all, we are at the crossroads of perhaps the most serious crisis in modern history, or in world history, because the destructive capabilities are such that World War III is not an abstract concept. It is something which is absolutely real. But we will only find out how real it is when it happens. But the accumulation of advanced weapon systems, nuclear but also chemical, biological weapons, climatic warfare, these bona fide weapons of mass destruction have reached a point where, in fact, they could be used to destroy humanity and lead the world to the unthinkable. And there's so many scientific studies to that effect. It's based, if you look at, well, I just got a contribution this morning from Helen Caldicott, who is a well-known author. I've known her for years, and I asked her to write up a piece on what's happening in the military bases where they store the weapons to be deployed in the case of a nuclear war. And she had documented this at an earlier period, that many of these people are either drunk or they're on drugs, they're taking LSD, or that they're simply, not at work, and so on and so forth. And in fact, this is documented from military sources. And bear in mind, it's very important, apart from the fact that Trump says, my button is bigger than yours, there's always the possibility of mistakes, technological mistakes. I run a website, and I can tell you I have glitches very frequently, practically every day. Okay? Now imagine what a glitch would imply with regard to the usage of nuclear weapons. And there's another, I mean, those are technical mistakes. And then there are so-called political mistakes. And political mistakes, let me elaborate on that. Those who decide on the use of nuclear weapons are unaware of the consequences of their actions. Why? Because within the military, within the political apparatus, there is an internal process of propaganda, which is not intended for the broader public. It's called top officials. That's a military concept. And what the top officials at all very high levels of government, military, business, are led to believe is that you can win a nuclear war, one, and two, that those weapons are harmless to civilians because the explosion is underground. I'm quoting from the Pentagon. And now it's a little bit like relabeling a pack of cigarettes. The more usable tactical nuclear weapon, low yield, one-third to 12 times a Hiroshima bomb, is, quote, harmless to civilians because the explosion is underground. These are bunker buster bombs. But how many feet underground do they actually go? I checked the data. It's the size of this building. Of course, the rubble comes up, and they don't even talk about radioactive fallout anymore. Okay? They don't talk about it. And so that propaganda is intended for people who take decisions. And now, does Mad Dog Mattis know what the impact of nuclear weapons is? It's a bit of harakiri, because taking that decision ultimately also kills U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. elites, and not to mention the corporations which are recipients of $1.2 trillion defense contracts to develop new nuclear weapons. They'll never be able to cash in on their profits unless they do it before. I'm being a bit cryptic, but the thing is that there's it's a diabolic agenda. It's based on lies, and then the lie becomes the truth, okay? And when the lie becomes the truth, there's no moving backwards. And that is what is happening. The lie becomes the truth. Peace, war becomes peace, and peace becomes, what we understand as peace is a conspiracy theory, okay? So that in that sense, we are living in what I'd call an inquisitorial environment. Because it's not so much even the question of obfuscating the lies. It is heralding the lie as truth, unquestionable truth. A bit like the witches during the Spanish Inquisition, okay? Or the French Inquisition was even worse. But that's another matter. But we look back at that. How is it they didn't understand, the logic behind this? But again, it's a very similar logic to what prevails today. And then we have terrorists coming in, attacking Western cities. Now, it just so happens that all those terrorists happen to be on the radar of the police and the intelligence. Then they find the passports somewhere, on the road or in the car or in the rubble. And then not a single one of these terrorist actually survives. They're suspects. They get shot dead. There's never any investigation. And then, referring to the Brussels attacks, it just so happens that the footage of the video passed when they attacked the airport, that was a couple of years back. What footage did they take? Moscow airport. They didn't have the footage for what really happened there. So they play around with the images. Now, nobody will dispute that. We've published that. Those are fake images and fake videos. But in the case of Brussels, what was quite striking is that in the morning, there was an attack at the airport. You remember those events. There's an attack at the airport, and then it was broadcast on the news, and they used the footage of Moscow airport. I happen to know that airport. And then in the afternoon, there was an attack in the metro station. And they took the metro station of Minsk, Belarus, which happened a few years earlier. So in other words, there was never any questioning. How is it? I can understand that there may be one fake video in the morning, but that both videos were fake. Okay? So that's the logic. We have these events which are there to intimidate the population and then, of course, and to endorse the narrative, the underlying narrative of the war on terrorism. Okay? They have to believe it. And for them to believe it, there have to be events in their daily lives. People have to be intimidated. And that's what's happening. They're intimidated. And they see, of course, Muslims as enemies of the state and so on. And then, of course, there's a vast campaign of Islamophobia. And then you ask yourself, why? Well, the answer is quite simple, but almost 70% of oil and natural gas happens to lie, I'm talking about the reserves, I'm not talking about tar sands, happens to lie in Muslim countries. And the area from, let's say, the tip of Saudi Arabia up to the Caspian Sea Basin, largely Muslim countries, is more than 60% of the global reserves of crude oil. Now, if those lands had been inhabited by Buddhists, we would be involved in a campaign against the Buddhists, obviously. You know, we're going after the Muslims because they happen to own the oil. We are in a situation where people who decide are actually war criminals. Okay? Obama is a war criminal. By now, I think Trump is also a war criminal. Okay? If you bomb a country illegally and kill civilians, you're a war criminal. If you impose a naval embargo on food and medicine, which is triggering at least a million people starving in Yemen, that's a war crime. And that's quite deliberate. There's the danger of a million people dying in Yemen because there is a naval blockade where the U.S. Navy is there. They're not letting any ships in so that the country is cut off from the rest of the world, doesn't get medicine, doesn't get food, and is involved in and is the subject of, I would say, U.S.-led bombings implemented by one of its proxies, Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. But U.S. advisors all over the place, and of course, special forces, Green Berets, are in Yemen. Okay? Now, we are led by war criminals. And I'm using the international definition of war crimes. And we also have a media which is complicit in this agenda, which is also responsible for war crimes. War propaganda is an illegal act under Nuremberg. And if we look at the timeline in the post 9/11 era, I think it's very clear, of course, that the 9/11 attacks were absolutely fundamental in setting the stage, well, first of all, setting the stage for the global war on terrorism. What happened? And that's where the media comes in, because they fail to underscore the political lies. At 11 o'clock in the morning, George Tenet, that's on the morning of 9/11, George Tenet states Al-Qaeda's behind it. Where did he have the evidence? There was no investigation which had been carried out. Two hours later, at 11 in the morning, I checked the news, George Tenet says, yes, Al-Qaeda's behind it. And then at 9 in the evening, they declare war on Afghanistan. And the following day, NATO, invoking Article 5 of the Washington Agreement, of their articles, etc., declares war on Afghanistan. Well, in fact, it was confirmed at a later date, but nonetheless, they say one member of NATO is attacked under the doctrine of collective security. All members of NATO have been attacked. That was the justification. Now, nobody knew about that. They didn't really understand the logic. Afghanistan was identified as a state sponsor of terrorism. Al-Qaeda was responsible. And then the day after, in Brussels, they invoke Article 5, and they say, we are now at war with Afghanistan. And then on the 7th of October, they invade Afghanistan. That's less than a month, okay? Now, there's several lies in that narrative. One, there was no proof it was Al-Qaeda, apart from the fact that Osama bin Laden was in a hospital bed in Rawalpindi, a military hospital under the auspices of the Pakistani military. He had a kidney problem, and he was admitted on the 10th. Now, was he actually, I'm being facetious, was he coordinating the 9/11 attacks from his handheld, in the hospital? And he was then, and then Rumsfeld said, we don't know where he is. It's like looking for a needle in the stack of hay. And in fact, they knew all along where he was, okay? And with modern technology, all you have to do is to slash a few, pieces of metal into his body, and you can use your GPS to go after him. Those technologies were available in 2001. But again, a whole series of lies. Now, the other big lie, when the war broke out in Afghanistan, is you cannot, under any circumstances, prepare a major theater war thousands of miles away in 28 days. Impossible. Okay? A war of that magnitude takes months and months and months, and sometimes years to prepare. But there wasn't a single military analyst who actually had the courage of saying, well, how come they managed to do that so quickly after 9/11 and have it, have the Air Force there going in? Ed took several months to prepare this meeting, right? Okay. How many months has it taken to prepare this meeting? Can you imagine a war run by the Pentagon with all its complexities, and they do it in 28 days?
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Today, As part of our summer series, we're airing a talk by Professor Michel Chosadovsky, presented June 8, 2018, entitled The Globalization of War, based on his book of the same name. This talk, along with other Global Research NewsHour broadcasts, are available for download at the website globalresearch.ca. Here's more from Professor Chosadovsky's address.
So, that is where I think that is where the perceptions of the public start to evolve. And that's where 9/11 truth and 9/11 lies play a crucial role. People are led to believe that they are threatened by terrorists, Islamic terrorists. There's a process of intimidation which takes place. The military concept behind that is called the massive casualty producing event. And it's a military concept. And it says the following: if you want to mobilize people's concerns and so on, you have to have dead people. You have to have casualties. And a massive casualty-producing event has the effect of creating, quote, a useful wave of indignation. I'm quoting a Pentagon document. It's from Operations Northwoods, which was a secret plan to have a false flag in relation to Cuba, killing people in the Miami Cuban community, and then there would be a useful wave of indignation. You can check that document. But the useful wave of indignation after 9/11, well, I wouldn't necessarily use that term in relation to 9/11, but nonetheless, without 9/11, they wouldn't have had the pretext and the justification to invade Afghanistan. The Taliban government actually approached the U.S. State Department twice and said, if you provide us some preliminary evidence concerning Osama bin Laden, we are prepared to deliver him to the U.S. justice system. Okay? So there is the number one terrorist who was the object of a whole series of, the saga went on. But of course, if you arrest the number one terrorist, you're left with a hole in your narrative. There can't be a global war against terrorism if you've arrested Osama bin Laden. Okay, so that was made on two occasions through diplomatic channels. It's the government, and they said, if you want us to deliver him, we will do it. And then George W. Bush said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Okay, so it was a bit a non sequitur, a circular type of thing. But the fact of the matter is that war was instigated with very little opposition. People were so shocked by what happened on September 11, they didn't want to even express their critique and say, well, Afghanistan didn't attack America. We didn't see any jet fighters in the skies of New York with an Afghani flag there. No, we didn't. What's the proof? Tell us. And that would have been a normal response to the statements made at the Atlantic Council on September 12, where they said, no, we're going to invade Afghanistan because Afghanistan has attacked a member state of the Atlantic Alliance. That was the discourse. And we were misinformed because none of this actually was reported in any meaningful way by the corporate media. Now, let me give you another big lie about which was not covered. We've covered it, and nobody really knows about it. There was a lot of discussion on what was called the Downing Street memos. Okay, I won't go back on the Downing Street memos, but there was something far more serious, and it had to do with Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations in early February 2001. And for people who recall that, Colin Powell came in and said, this is a very authoritative report by British intelligence, blah, blah, blah. Okay? And he said, weapons of mass destruction, and then he quoted from the report, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And British intelligence provided us with this report, and that was the basis upon which the war on Iraq was justified. And there was very little questioning of where this intelligence report came from, although we knew, because a professor at Cambridge, Glenn Rangwala, read the report and he said, it looks familiar. And he started then looking at the quotations and discovered that the report had been copied and pasted off the internet. It was plagiarized. And he managed, and he proved it. It was an incredible achievement, because there were certain even typos he went back to the original sources, and in fact they copied it from a PhD document which was being presented in California. And so that report was aired on Channel 4. A Guardian, I think, did publish excerpts. I was in touch with him. We published the whole document. Then, but it was not used as a means to question the legitimacy of Colin Powell's lies, statements, at the United Nations Security Council. Okay? Nobody stood up, came up and said, well, according to Glenn Rangwala, you plagiarized. That report is... And that report wasn't prepared by British intelligence. It was prepared by public relations officers in the office of Tony Blair. Okay? Now, that was one element of the war in Iraq which very few people know about, because essentially it wasn't covered. Okay? It simply wasn't covered. The global war on terrorism is fake. Al-Qaeda is a U.S. intelligence construct. We're presenting war as a responsibility to protect and a GWAT. That's the global war on terrorism. And then, of course, we have the doctrine of preemptive warfare. Now, preemptive warfare was developed in 2001, and it was the Nuclear Posture Review, and it pertained precisely to these tactical nuclear weapons. But the notion of preemptive nuclear war is that you use nuclear weapons to defend yourself, and you actually go and bomb a country with nuclear weapons as a means to defending yourself, even if that country doesn't even have nuclear weapons. And I can tell you that Libya was one of the first countries to be which had been, according to Pentagon documents, they had envisaged using tactical B-61 bombs, buster bunker bombs with nuclear warheads against Libya. The project was abandoned, but it was announced by the Pentagon. That was during the Clinton administration. Okay, and again, then you had the preemptive nuclear war, which says, and preemptive war in general. Okay, you attack a country to prevent it from attacking you. Okay. But, of course, America is situated several thousand miles from where that country happens to be. So this doctrine becomes embedded in U.S. foreign policy. But I should also mention that if we start doing a little bit of background history – the doctrine that we're experiencing in the post 9/11 period has its roots essentially in the early years after World War II. The first nuclear weapon was dropped on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And Harry Truman made the statement on August 9th when the second bomb was dropped. It was a long speech. He was coming back from the Potsdam conference in Germany, but he said, I quote, "The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base, and that was because we wanted to save the lives of innocent civilians," unquote. Now, that doctrine of collateral damage has been persistent, but in fact, what we notice in U.S. military doctrine, even going back to the later period, the last year of World War II, where you had these massive use of firebombs and the bombings of German cities. They were civilian targets exclusively, okay? And the same thing in Japan, exclusively civilian targets. That doctrine ultimately then prevailed in the early 50s when you had the Korean War, the massive casualties which occurred from 1950 to 53, where 30% of the population of North Korea was killed. Now, from their standpoint, the United States is a threat to their national security. Of course, Americans present it the other way around. North Korea is a threat to our security. Well, we happen to have killed 30% of its population. Okay? That's about the size of California. No, that would be 20%. 60 million people out of more than 300 million. But bear in mind, the U.S. military actually acknowledges, because if you look at a quotation of General Curtis LeMay, who says, "We must have killed what? In the course of 18 months of bombing, what? 20% of the population and the totality of the cities, 98% of the cities. The crimes committed to in relation to the Korean people are there's no other precedent in history. Okay, if you look at World War II, the countries which lost the largest share of their population were Soviet Union, Germany, and Yugoslavia, primarily those three countries. But we're not talking about as far as Russia was, Soviet Union is concerned, it was about 10% of the population. But there we're talking about 30% of the population. And then, of course, today when we discuss denuclearization, we fail to understand what this country went through and what it went through in the aftermath of the Korean War, where every single year it is threatened by nuclear weapons. Every single year since 1950. I should also mention another thing, is that already in 1945, the United States had formulated a plan to bomb. That was when the United States and the Soviet Union were allies on the 15th of September 1945. Barely a few weeks after the end of World War II, they released, it's a declassified document, they had a plan to bomb 204 cities across the Soviet Union. And that plan was formulated in 1942. It wasn't formulated during the Cold War. It was first formulated in 1942. It was released in 1945. And then they had another set of plans which go to the 60s, but then we're in the Cold War era. Well, that's another matter. I don't want to get into it. But the thing is that the nuclear doctrine, which emerges, goes back to Truman and the so-called Truman Doctrine. But now, if you look at, because next week, of course, it's the summit in Singapore. I'm leaving, incidentally, after this event. I'm off to South Korea, okay? Precisely for events which are held in relation to that summit they're different venues, but one is in the South Korean parliament, where they at least have the courtesy of inviting a conspiracy theorist. But what I'd like to say, to put this thing in perspective, North Korea has about 10 nuclear bombs. I haven't looked at the most recent data. It might be more than that. Okay, the United States at 4,000. But Belgium has five times more nuclear weapons than North Korea. There's a whole series of European countries. We never mention them. They have nuclear weapons, okay? They have nuclear weapons. And I'm talking about Belgium, Holland, Germany, Italy, and Turkey. Turkey has 90. Now they're less, about 50, okay? But I mean, I have the figures on this. In other words, and it's amply documented. Yes, Belgium had 20, at least double what North Korea has. They have B-61-11 tactical nuclear weapons. So there you have five non-nuclear, so-called non-nuclear states, which have nuclear weapons made in America under national command. That means that under international law they are nuclear weapon states, even if they don't produce the nuclear weapons. Now you have the situation of Germany. Now Germany is a nuclear weapon state as well. A, it has under national command tactical nuclear weapons, B-61, and at the same time, through its partnership with Aerospatiale Matra, and which ultimately then, and Deutsche Aerospace, which ultimately then merges into a new company called EADES, European Air Defense System Corporation, Germany produces nuclear weapons for the French Navy. Okay, that's all right. So the French are official nuclear weapon state, but the weapons, the nuclear bombs, are produced in a binational partnership, but which it's a Franco-German company. Okay, but nobody points their finger at Germany or Italy or Belgium or the Netherlands, not to mention Israel, which has some 400 nuclear weapons. Okay. And Japan most probably has nuclear weapons capabilities. So there we are, a small country in Northeast Asia, which chose to develop nuclear weapons after having been threatened with nuclear war for more than half a century, because that came rather late. They are now pinpointed. They are, incidentally, North Korea is the only nuclear weapons state that voted in favor of the motion of the United Nations General Assembly presented by the International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons. They voted in favor of that campaign. The media will never even mention it. And the countries that voted, there were several countries abstained, including China, India, and Pakistan. They abstained. And the rest of the gang, including Russia, voted against. But North Korea, that was their policy, is they are against nuclear weapons, but they have developed nuclear weapons as a means of deterrence. Now, what I don't think much is going to come of this agreement, of this summit next week. There will be, of course, a show, but I don't think that the North Koreans will actually accept to denuclearize without receiving something in exchange. Now, there's a tremendous dichotomy or imbalance, because you have 4,000 nuclear weapons plus $1.2 trillion allocated to new nuclear weapons on the one hand, and then you have a country which has about 10 nuclear bombs with limited delivery capabilities. But again, the real threat to global security is the United States of America, particularly in view of this, the fact that it is spending billions and billions of taxpayers' money for the development of its weapons arsenal. Now, let me conclude and maybe raise some of the economic and social dimensions, how this war economy ultimately, how this war economy leads to certain restructuring of the global economy. The two most dynamic sectors, and we're living under a neoliberal agenda, the two most dynamic economic sectors of the global economy, guess what? Weapons production on the one hand, and luxury goods on the other. Luxury goods, including entertainment, hotels, travel and leisure, infrastructure, and so on and so forth, which is geared to an upper income market. Why? Because the New World Order is characterized by extensive austerity measures, neoliberal phasing out of social programs, which are there essentially also to free the funds which finance the war economy. Okay, you can't spend $1.2 trillion on nuclear weapons and then at the same time finance your health services. Okay, so that there is a fiscal structure underlying this. So the weapons industry is very, very prosperous. It's doing very well. And then it creates also corporate lobby groups, which are pushing, of course, to get these contracts. I'm convinced that Lockheed Martin doesn't necessarily want to blow up the planet. They're not interested in that. They're interested in getting the money. Now, if you had a government which were committed to peace, they would then say, okay, Lockheed Martin, we will fund your civilian aircraft. But in fact, they're doing exactly the opposite. Boeing has lost its contracts with Iran, delivery of civilian aircraft. But that doesn't matter, because Boeing is also producing jet fighters and missiles and so on. And the whole process underlying nuclear weapons has been privatized. I don't have time to get into that. It goes back to a secret meeting which was held at Strategic Command headquarters in 2003, I believe, where the private sector was invited in and they established the doctrine for the expansion of the nuclear weapons industry. But again, to get back to the economic and social dimensions, we are living the most serious economic crisis in world history, where vast sectors of the population are driven into beyond poverty, into total despair. And this is not due to a lack of resources by any means. It is essentially due to the fact that you have a process of economic expansion, which is ultimately strictly based on profit, which destroys the environment, If we look at farming, it's the whole issue of the genetically modified seeds. It's the reproduction of the agricultural cycle. The agricultural cycle is dead in many countries. When you don't reproduce food, or when the reproduction of food depends on authority of Bayer Monsanto, where farmers can't reproduce their seeds, there is a very serious problem. And that is tied into the military agenda. There are many examples of this happening around the world. India, where you see Indian farmers committing suicide. Ethiopia, the whole structure of biodiversity has been destroyed as a result of the influx of genetically modified seeds. And that happened after a U.S. engineered war. Okay? So all these things, in essence, are interconnected. And I think it points, again, to the need to have a very broad-based mass movements. It's not a simple matter. And maybe we can discuss it later on, but David is going to focus on that. But we need desperately to rebuild a mass movement which is not dependent on corporate financing, which is the norm today. Okay. I'm on the blacklist of the World Social Forum, and then I was at a conference in Brazil, which was on the invitation of the landless farmers. Okay. And then we were discussing the World Social Forum, and I said, you can't expect to be able to take on a progressive stance against the Rockefellers when the Rockefellers are paying for your expenses, okay? But, I mean, that's true. You look at who's funding all these NGOs. It's Soros, it's Rockefeller, it's the MacArthur Foundation, it's the NED, and so on. So obviously, you can't, if you say, well, I'm against U.S. support for Al-Qaeda, they cut your money off immediately, okay? So there's a whole load of people there, of leftist progressives, getting money from foundations, and that in itself is a means to, in fact, destroying the mass movement altogether. We let them protest, but within certain norms and certain realms. We have progressive intellectuals, but many of those progressive intellectuals are supportive of U.S. foreign policy. And that is something which is absolutely fundamental if we want to rebuild an anti-war movement in Canada. We have to start. We have to be independent. We have to be sovereign, and we are not taking the money from corporations or governments, because that would tie us down. Thank you very much.
We just heard a presentation by Professor Michelle Chosudovsky in the city of Regina, Saskatchewan, on June 8, 2008, on the topic of the globalization of war. The talk was based on his 2015 book, The Globalization of War, America's Long War on Humanity, which is available for purchase at the site globalresearch.ca. The audio of the talk was recorded by videographer Paul S. Graham. The unabridged video recording can be found on the Paul S. Graham YouTube channel. Music was by Purple Planet Music. More selections are available at the site www.purple-planet.com. The Global Research News Hour will return next week with more special summer programming. My name is Michael Welch.